this book, Miss Abigail Adams. The author, Miss Evelyn Witter.
Published by Mott Media of Milford, Michigan, in 1981.
We are indebted to Evelyn Witter and Mott Media, Milford, Michigan, for the copyright. Your honorary reader is Muriel Ferris. This is the foreword by Evelyn Witter. Now and then in the recorded history of America, a person comes on the scene who remains for all time an inspiration to Christians. Such a woman was Abigail Adams. A born-again Christian, her whole life was guided by his word. She was steadfast through fortune and misfortune. As a second First Lady, she was President John Adams' partner. Many of her precepts helped guide and mold America. Her own son, John Quincy Adams, who she trained up in God's word, was the sixth president. Her relationships with the people of her world, her letters, her acts of faith and courage have come down to us as an important part of our heritage.
Part 1.
Chapter 1. Happy Birthday. It was the magical day of November 18, 1749. My fifth birthday, and Grandma Quincy was coming from Mount Wollaston. You can be sure I was excited. It wasn't only the trunk of presents Grandma Quincy would bring that excited me, even if my seven-year-old sister Mary said it was. What excited me most was the way Grandmother always told the story of my birth. I never tired of hearing about the Indians, tomahawk and snowstorm. I ran patiently from one window to the next, squinting hardest at the north window. I knew Grandmother would come from Mount Wollaston to the north of us. Be patient, my father, Reverend William Smith, smiled at me as he threw another log into the fireplace. Grandmother and grandfather will come. As it says in Ecclesiastes, the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. But it was hard to have patience and be excited too. Now the snow began to fall, giving me a new worry. In Weymouth, Massachusetts, storms were often big, keeping people in their homes for days. Snowflakes hit the window pane. Snow already covered the ground. And now, with the coming of more snow, grandmother and grandfather would surely have to come by sleigh. Then Tom, our hired man, called out, "They're here, they're here." I heard the welcome crunch of the sleigh runners on the snow and the steady rhythm of the horses' hoofs as they drew near. The horses' breath hung in the air as puffs of white haze. Grandfather Quincy hoisted grandmother down and they hurried towards the house. "Grandmother, grandfather," I shouted, and soon they were hugging me and their kisses dampened my lips and cheeks. Mother and father helped hang their great coats in the closet. Phoebe, our hired girl, served hot tea beside the fire and quickly took away the foot warmers Tom brought in from the sleigh. My sister Mary and I sat quietly but impatiently waiting for the present time. The grown-ups talked and talked. We smiled knowingly as my younger brother Will saw his chance to grab a quince tart from the tea table. Mother whacked his hand and he sat scowling in the corner. Will was never careful of his manners. "Oh!" escaped from my lips as Tom brought in grandmother's trunk. I crossed in front of the hearth to stand as close as possible to it. The fire was sending flickering lights which reflected off the lemon-coloured satin curtains. My eyes traced the patterns on a thick Brussels carpet with green leaves and lemon-coloured flowers. I thought I'd burst if I didn't soon see the gifts. As I looked at the grown-ups, I smiled. It was my birthday, and my aunts and grandparents were gathered here to celebrate with me. How great are my blessings, I thought. Grandmother interrupted my dreaming with, "Nabby, bring the shawl I left on my last visit. It's in your room, I believe." I wanted to run for the shawl, but I knew grandmother would say running wasn't ladylike. I moved quickly nonetheless, because the sooner I got the shawl, the sooner I would get my presents and hear Grandmother tell the story. But I forgot about being ladylike when I came down the stairs my special way. I went down 1, 2, 3 stairs quickly, then paused on the 4th. I took the 5th, 6th, and 7th stairs very fast, and then on the count of 8 I took a little bounce that landed me right on the entry floor. Father watched me with his large brown eyes. He was sitting very stiffly, his wide shoulders hunched a bit, the same way they did when he ploughed. "Abigail," Mother said, "I told you not to come down the stairs like that." Why, it's like dancing." "I know," I said, "and a clergyman's daughter isn't supposed to dance. It's really not dancing, Father. It's just the way I walk sometimes." "I know," Father said gently. "Now, child," said Grandmother Quincy, drawing the shawl about her slim shoulders, "here is the key. When you have received your other gifts, you may open the trunk. There are some things in it for your birthday." At that moment, Mother, Mary, and Will put something into my hand. 2 bayberry candles for my room," I exclaimed. Mary and Will knew how much I appreciated the sweet bayberry scent after the homemade, smoky, greasy-smelling candles made of tallow and other animal fats. "Thank you," I said. My sister and brother saw by my happy face how much they had pleased me and grinned back at me. Then Phoebe, her black face glowing, took something from her apron pocket. 2 maple sugar confections. Phoebe had made them herself, and no one could make maple confections quite like Phoebe. "Happy birthday, Miss Nabby," Phoebe smiled. I hugged dear Phoebe and told her these would be saved to nibble on later. Aunt Mary reached behind her. "These 3 aprons are from your 3 aunts, dear," she said. "They'll save my good clothes while I do the chores," I said. "Yes, indeed," said Aunt Anne. Aunt Elizabeth nodded in agreement. "Now," Mother said, reaching for a box beside her chair, "here is something you've been waiting for a long time." I opened the lid and there lay a white fur muff. "Oh, how beautiful it is, Mother," I exclaimed. "Oh, thank you, thank you." I pushed my hands inside the muff and felt its softness and warmth. "No more cold hands at Sunday services," I said. Then Father moved beside me. "Nabby," he said, "what I have in my waistcoat pocket was made by a good friend of ours. He's a fine silversmith who lives in Boston named Paul Revere. He has fashioned this for you." Father took an object from his waistcoat pocket and placed it in my hand. It was a silver inkwell with simple lines and fine engraving. "I shall treasure it forever, Father," I said. "And use it daily," Father added, with that schoolmaster look he sometimes gave me. "It is time to open the trunk," Grandmother Quincy said. My fingers trembled turning the key and lifting the lid. There on top was a blue dress with crewel work embroidery trim. "Oh, Grandmother," I cried, "it's lovely." I gave the dress to Mother to admire and pass around the circle of relatives while I dug deeper into the trunk. There were books, and more books. "They came on the Gideon from England," Grandfather explained. I was glad to have books. Since I was thought to be too delicate to go to school, Father taught me at home. I spent much time in Father's study. I liked it there. The shelves were full of books. Of course, I couldn't read many of them yet, but I was learning. I read scripture. Well, not exactly, but I had heard certain passages so often that I could guess at most of the words. Father first began teaching me my letters and numbers when I was 4. Today I was 5 and could really read. At first, Father used the hornbook, which was made up of pages from the New England Primer. It was covered with thin, clear sheets of horn. In less than a year, I could read parts of the Catechism and some of the hymns in the Bay Psalm book. Once I heard Father tell Mother, "She's the smartest child in Weymouth." Mother said, Abigail learns easily, yes, but she is too delicate to walk the 2 miles across the fields to the dame's school as Mary does. Then said Father, I'll continue teaching her at home. I hardly had time to look at all my books from Grandmother when Mother said, it's time for dinner. We're having maple sugar for the corn pudding, Nabby, in honour of your birthday. Father said especially long prayers for the occasion. I tried to listen to every word, but my mind kept slipping into thoughts of the great story of my birth we would hear after dinner. Corn pudding was always the first course in our house, as it was in most New England households. Father took his time carving the chicken. Today Phoebe seemed especially slow, bringing the biscuits and the milk. And then the men started talking about the Molasses Act of 1733 and about a French expedition which was now on the Ohio River, burying lead plates every so often, marking where they thought the French territory was. Father said an English company of Virginia planters with a royal patent was surveying the same territory. Suddenly Father jumped to his feet crying, God save the King! That salute to George II usually ended political discussions. Today I was especially grateful to hear it. I wanted to listen to Grandmother Quincy talk about me. I soon got my wish. Everyone moved back to the sitting room, and Mother said, how well I remember this date 5 years ago. Yes, said Grandmother, 5 years ago today our dear Abigail was born. What a memorable day that was. I took the footstool and sat next to Grandmother, my elbows resting on her knee. I looked up into the pleasant face framed by her prettiest lace cap. Tell us, Grandmother, I said, settling comfortably on the stool. Should I start with the Indians, Grandmother asked. No, giggled Mary, please start at the beginning. Grandmother looked affectionately from one to the other of the group, but her eyes rested on me at last, and from then on I had the feeling that she was talking mostly to me. She petted the top of my head with her soft white hand, and the silk of her dress rustled deliciously. Grandmother began. It was a fearful night. The snow was so thick that the houses were solid white. The wind whipped and whistled with the fierceness of a gale at sea. There was no sign of light anywhere in Weymouth except right here in this house. Candles burned in every room and no one complained, even though they knew the precious candle supply was fast disappearing. Abigail, you were born that night, but you were extremely tiny. After a few days, we decided to send an Indian runner to get Father Quincy. We decided the baby was too small and too delicate to survive. He must come before we lost her. Reverend Smith thought the baby didn't look any worse than she had, but even he wasn't sure about her condition. I didn't express what I thought. Grandmother shook her head knowingly. Aunt Elizabeth went downstairs to Aunt Mary and Aunt Anne and told them that we all felt the baby was too delicate to live much longer. The little thing is about the same, Aunt Elizabeth told the other aunts. It's well that the Indian runner went after Grandfather Quincy. I doubt if she will live another day. Then by the time light was breaking, Reverend Smith sent Tom out to the barn to hitch up a horse. Tom began clearing the road between the parsonage and the meeting house by dragging a heavy log over it. People looked out at their houses. They didn't think anyone would be going to the parsonage this day. They were curious. What are you doing, Tom? They called out. Clearing the way for Reverend Smith and his family, Tom called back to them. Reverend Smith is going to baptize his baby daughter today. She's very sickly and not likely to live. The mother wants her to have a name, so they are going ahead with the christening, whether or not. Grandmother Quincy paused. She stroked my hair lovingly. Then Grandmother went on with the story. It seemed like just a few minutes after Tom cleared the road that people began coming. They brought potions of every kind. Some were made of boiled snails or worms or even more loathsome ingredients. They smelled spoiled and offended the nose. I did give the baby a tiny taste and she screamed at the top of her lungs. The three aunts were kept busy answering the door. I wanted to help them, but Abigail cried when I tried to put her back in her cradle. so many people came that even little Mary helped by running to the door and letting people in. I did not know what to do with all the medicine people brought. Each person was sure her medicine would be best for the baby, but Abigail didn't want any of it. It was nice of people to show so much concern, Mother said. Everyone loved Reverend Smith and his wife, even as they do now, Aunt Anne spoke up for the first time. Grandmother continued. The Reverend decided to hurry on with the christening, but my daughter, the baby's mother, wanted to wait for her father. Aunt Mary didn't think waiting was wise. She was sure he couldn't get through because one could not see the road. It was completely covered over with snow. I told them a snowstorm won't stop my husband. Colonel John Quincy will be here. It was the strangest thing. No sooner had I made that statement than we heard shouts outside. When I looked out, I saw Colonel Quincy and two other people, all on horseback, coming towards the house. When they got closer, I could see the two riders with him were Indians. One was the chief of the Pongapoag Indians, and the other was the Indian runner, Robert, who had gone to bring the colonel. The Indians had come to honour the granddaughter of their friend. "Did you take me downstairs to see the Indians?" I asked. I knew the answer, but somehow Grandmother always expected me to ask at this part of the story. "Not immediately," smiled Grandmother. "We had to dress you for the christening first." "What did Abigail wear?" Mary asked. This was the part Grandmother seemed to enjoy the most, and we knew it. Grandmother settled back in her chair and looked straight ahead as if seeing the scene all over again. Then she began counting on her fingers as she spoke. There were stacks of long petticoats trimmed with lace and embroidery. There was a dress of the finest cambric that I had made for the baby's mother when she was christened. Then there was that elegant hood and a silk jacket and several white woolen blankets. You were then taken downstairs, Abigail. Everyone looked at the baby and they all remarked how sweet she was. But there was a sadness all around. Everyone was thinking the baby would never grow much bigger. This little angel would never live to run, play, skip and hop, they thought. It was then Grandfather Quincy got his first look at his granddaughter, Abigail. He said, "I thought you said the baby was thin. She's fat." That remark of the colonel's broke through some of the gloom. Actually, the baby did look fat because she had on so many clothes. In fact, she looked like a fat little feather bed. It was then my husband said, "She'll be all right. We'll be proud of her some day." He turned to the Indian chief and asked, "What do you think, Chief Mummenstilb?" I walked right over to the chief and laid Abigail in his arms. The chief studied the baby for a while and then he said, "She's little, but she'll live to be a great lady like her grandmother." "Wasn't that a nice thing for him to say?" I exclaimed, as I always did at this part of the story. "Yes," smiled Mother, and when he gave my baby back to my mother, he gave her a doeskin robe the Indian women had made. Grandmother went on. Tom came in at that moment and whispered to me that it was getting colder and that it would be best if we got on with it. When we got outside, the icy wind grabbed our breaths right out of our bodies. I led the way with Abigail in my arms. Neighbours joined us, and when we reached the meeting house, almost all of Weymouth was with us. Of course, as we walked along, I had no idea how the baby was under the robe. I couldn't feel her stirring. Once inside the meeting house, when I lifted the robe, I was so relieved. The darling little thing was sound asleep. The Reverend Smith hastened into the baptismal ceremony, and when he went to the baptismal font, the water was frozen. There was no heat in the meeting house, and he was afraid the baby would suffer bad effects from the cold. He was anxious to have the ceremony over quickly. Reverend Smith hit the ice on the font with his fist, but it didn't break. The old Indian chief saw the trouble. He reached inside his robe, drew out a tomahawk, and gave it to the Reverend Smith. With one tomahawk whack, the ice broke, and the ceremony proceeded. I named the baby Abigail for the Reverend Smith's mother. I'm glad you named me Abigail after Father's mother, I said. Grandmother patted my hand and went on with her story. We hurried back to the house. Phoebe had roasted turkeys, chickens, geese, beef and hams ready. The pantry shelves were filled with custards, puddings, pies and cakes too. In the big brick oven next to the open fireplace, pans of cornbread smelt delicious. Reverend Smith was grateful for this day, and before we ate he offered a beautiful prayer of heartfelt thankfulness. Then he wrote in the church record. "May I show that entry?" Father asked, reaching for the record book. He opened it to the page where he had written, "I baptized my daughter today, November 25, 1744. Everyone looked at the entry and nodded their approval. "When you wrote that about Abigail, I asked you what you were writing, didn't I, Father?" Mary asked. "Yes," smiled Father, "I told you then that the baby's name was Abigail." "Yes," Mary smiled back, "and I hurried over to my aunts to tell them the name, and when they asked me what it was, I told them Nabby." That was as close as you could get to Abigail. Before long, everyone was calling Abigail Nabby, Father added to the story. Grandmother Quincy took up the story again. For weeks, people stopped in to see how the baby was. They wanted to look at her and to give their advice. They always went away shaking their heads. Some said, "Be prepared. It looks as if she isn't long for this world." "But they were all wrong," Grandfather Quincy cut in. "She did live, as I told them from the first that she would." Then everyone clapped and I made a curtsy, and the children were allowed to run into the kitchen to play. That was a happy day. But not far ahead, dark clouds were to hang over the Smith household because of a fire in Weymouth that could be seen many miles away in Boston. Chapter 2. Explosion. It was a sweet April day when I discovered a secret about the meeting house. Nature was coming awake for the summer, and every day new growths were springing out. The trees were pushing out their first burst of tender green. I could see buttercups nodding in the breeze near the meeting house, and there was early violets blooming at the edge of the woods. On this April Saturday, Father and Will strolled up to the meeting house to talk with Sam, the church sexton, who took care of the building. Mary and I started the stroll with them, but we were stopped by Mrs. Trudy, who always asked too many questions, and Mrs. Pratt, who lived far up on a hill nearby. Father and Will were at the meeting house long before we finished our visit. As we skipped along, I could hear Mother's remark to Phoebe that very morning, and I did try to be more ladylike. Mother had said, "I'm glad Abigail is so friendly, but have you noticed how undignified she is? She runs and strides like a boy. We can't have that. I've been so concerned with her health, I fear I have neglected her manners." "She's the friendliest girl in Massachusetts," Phoebe had answered, "always looking out for other people. She's a Christian, Mr. Smith. She's a good Christian girl." We got to the meeting house when Father was saying to Sam, "I must take a look at the garret." Father went inside and up the stairs to the balcony. He went straight to the door that led to the garret. His hands rubbed along the moulding until they found a key. I started to follow him, but he turned quickly and said, "No, Abigail, you must wait here with Mary and Will. I can't allow children in the garret." "Why not?" I asked. Father was already out of sight. Sam rubbed his chin as if considering whether to answer me or not. He decided to tell me why, because he said, "The town's supply of gunpowder is up there. We have 3 barrels of it. It could blow us all to glory. No place for children." Mary began to bite her lip and wriggle, like she always does when she's nervous. "What is our father doing up in the garret with all that gunpowder?" she asked. "Well," explained Sam, scratching his head, "since he's the pastor here at Weymouth, he's thought to be responsible for the whole town. You see what I mean, miss? Being responsible the way he is, he wants to make sure the gunpowder is dry. He'll be sure to look over the rifles, too, to make sure they'll be ready in case we need them." Mary shook her head as if she understood, but I had the feeling that what Sam told us confused her. We waited for Father, and when we walked home, I asked, "Why do the people of Weymouth keep gunpowder and rifles in the meeting house?" "Because, Nabby, the meeting house is the safest place," Bob explained. "It's dry up in the garret, and there aren't any fireplaces and chimneys from which sparks can fly and set the gunpowder afire." "What if it stormed and lightning hit the steeple?" Mary asked Nabby. "That would start a fire," Father said. "Why do we have gunpowder and guns?" I asked. "All towns must be prepared," Father explained. "Towns north of us need ammunition to fight the French and the Indians. We don't need it for those purposes because your grandfather Quincy made friends with the Indians in our part of the country. You should be aware of that, Nabby, after knowing what a friendly part the Indians played in your christening." "Then why do we have gunpowder and guns?" I asked. "We are safe as long as we have the English Navy to protect us," Father said. "But we take precautions in case the Navy couldn't help us when a need came." By this time, we had come to the blacksmith shop, and Father went inside to talk to the men and learn the news from Boston. It was then I missed Will. "Have you seen Will, Mary?" I asked my sister. "I hope he hasn't run off again," Mary explained. "Mother expects us to watch out for him, you know." We called, "Will!" But there was no answer. "Will!" We looked up and down Church Street. Finally, we saw him in an open field in the back of the blacksmith's. He was with three older boys who had muskets. When we got close to them, I heard Will say, "The key's up over the doorway to the garret." "Will!" I shouted at him. "You are not supposed to tell that." "That's all right," the big boy Isaac grinned. "We just want a little gunpowder for our muskets." "That gunpowder is there for grown-ups, in case we need to fight an enemy," I told him. "The French and Indians don't come around here, and besides, we've got the English Navy to protect us," Eben said. "Nobody will know the difference anyway. Nobody will see us. We'll be as quiet as ghosts," Benjamin added. "Ghosts aren't quiet," I told him. "Phoebe says they make an awful scary noise." "You won't tell I told about the gunpowder, will you, Nabby?" Will asked. "You won't tell, will you?" His voice sounded smothered with fear. "Promise, Nabby, promise," he begged. "Father would be in a fury if he knew. Promise." I didn't want to promise, but Will was in such a state, and Father was just coming up from the blacksmith's. I blurted out the words, "I promise," and the moment I said it, I was sorry I had promised. I was unhappy. What would God think about what I had done? I knew I had to stop the boys from taking any gunpowder. I knew that even being near gunpowder was dangerous. Besides, if they took a little this time, what would stop them from taking even more the next time? Gradually, they could take so much that the supply wouldn't be enough to help the townspeople if they were attacked. Most of all, I was helping boys to steal, and there was no doubt that that was wrong. I knew I should tell Father. Still, Father always said a promise is a sacred trust. It must not be broken. What was I to do? I went to bed early, and Mother was glad I was taking extra rest. She was always worrying about my health, but I wasn't thinking about my health on this night. I was thinking about the boys and how they could blow up the whole town, or at the very least, rob the town of its only defense. What was I to do? I sat at my bedroom window and looked out into the peaceful night. I prayed and asked God to show me the right answer. I could hear the clock tick. I could hear Rover, our dog, yawning as he lay by the fireplace downstairs. Listening to Rover gave me a thought. He barked when it was important to bark. He was a good dog, always aware of what was going on around him. If Rover was at the meeting house when the boys came there, he would bark. His bark would awaken the sexton. The sexton would chase the boys away, and everything would be all right. Rover was the answer to my prayers. I would take Rover to the meeting house. Quickly I dressed, threw on a warm shawl, and crept down the stairs. Rover came out into the entryway. I patted him and whispered in his ear to follow me. We ran all the way to the meeting house. I was hoping we were in time. We were. When we got inside the building, we heard footsteps. I told Rover to be quiet and pulled him with me up the steps to the balcony. I ran to the garret door and tried the knob. It opened. Father must have forgotten to lock the door. I pushed Rover in, closed the door, and sat down beside him on the bottom step. Immediately after that, I heard the boys' voices. One said, "Did you hear something?" Another said, "Yes, it sounded like something dragging across a floor." The third boy said, "If it's a ghost, we'll fight him together." His voice shook and trembled, though. Rover scratched at the garret door. He wanted to get out. The boy's voice said, "I think I heard a hoof. An old lady told me once that the devil has hoofs, and I'm going home this very minute." "You stay right here," first boy's voice said. "I'll go first. Come on, follow me." When the footsteps sounded on the top step, I thought Rover would bark, but he didn't. He nuzzled closer to me. I had to do something quickly. Suddenly I thought about the boy's fear of ghosts, and I let out a most mournful ghost-like moan. It was such a loud moan that it bounced on the walls of the meeting house and echoed back. Then there was the noise of running and scrambling on the stairs. The sounds of the boys' running feet came up to the garret, and I knew they were racing for their homes. Rover and I went home. He hadn't barked to awaken the sexton as I had planned, but we had saved the gunpowder all the same. At the entryway, Rover left me to return to the fireside, and I returned to my bed. Dreamily, I hoped I wouldn't have to be a ghost again as I fell asleep smiling. It was another clear night many weeks later, when I had almost forgotten about the boys trying to take the gunpowder from the meeting house, that I was awakened by a bright light in my room. I knew it couldn't be the sun. I turned towards Mary, who shared my bed, and tried to waken her. "Mary, Mary," I said, "wake up. Our room is light and it isn't morning yet." Mary blinked. "The light is so bright, it's flickering," she stammered. I heard loud crackling noises outside, and then Father came running up the stairs calling, "Abigail, Mary, wake up. The meeting house is on fire. Our home may be next." Father dashed into our room and pulled the coverlets from our bed. "Father," Mary cried, "what are you doing?" "There's no time to dress, Mary." Father's deep voice was vibrant with excitement. "Wrap yourselves in the coverlets and put on your shoes." "What about the others?" I gasped as I tugged with the shoe ribbons. "Your mother has baby Betsy and Will, Will was the first to see the fire. He woke us." Mary was screaming and holding onto the bedpost. She was helpless with fear. I knew I had to help Mary with her shoes. She couldn't seem to move. Father saw what was happening, and he forced Mary's shoe on one foot and then handed me the other foot and the shoe. Mother's voice came up to us from below. She was calling Father and telling him that the flames at the meeting house were climbing to the steeple. "Abigail," Father shouted, "the town's gunpowder is stored in the steeple. It may blow up any minute. Run!" Father pushed me ahead of him down the steep stairs. I almost lost my balance. I swayed dizzily. I heard Mary moan. She was so limp that Father gathered her up in his arms and carried her down the stairs. When we got outside the parsonage, I saw a long line of men passing leather water buckets from the well to the parsonage, where they threw the water on the house. "We'll save your house, Reverend," one of the men said. "We're dampening it down good, but we can't save the meeting house." "There's gunpowder in the meeting house," Father shouted. "It may blow up any minute. Run, save yourselves." Instantly, everyone began to push and shove. I saw people running in every direction, their eyes wild with fear. I saw Will helping Mother, who was carrying baby Betsy close in her arms. I grabbed onto Father's cloak and we ran. Father was still carrying Mary in his arms. Then there was a thunderous noise. The dark sky above turned red. Flaming boards flew through the air like birds of fire. I fell over something, and then everything went quiet and black. When I opened my eyes, I was lying on the ground. Father was sitting beside me and had thrown his cloak over me. The air hung with smoke and was hard to breathe. "What's happened?" I asked. "The men saved the parsonage with their water buckets," Father said. I saw Mother sitting on the ground not far away. She was cradling Mary in her arms. Mary buried her face in Mother's shoulder. A sob escaped her lips now and then. Mother said, "Come, girls, we must make a good breakfast for all our friends." I took Mary's hand and we walked back to the house together. Some of the men who had worked in the bucket brigade walked with us. As they walked along, they talked about the fire. I heard men ask each other, "How do you suppose the fire started?" No one seemed to know. Father said a small spark could have been the cause. It has been dry, you know, and a single spark, like a spark from a foot warmer, could have started a fire. A foot warmer. A foot warmer. I began remembering what I had seen at Sunday services. I remembered the Simpsons were the last to come to service. Mr. Simpson, one of the richest sheep men in Massachusetts, explained that he had been shearing sheep until long after the sun had gone down the night before and had overslept this Sabbath morning. Mrs. Simpson had explained to Father that she had been feeling poorly these last few days and was grateful that she could come at all. But for the foot warmer, she said, I would be obliged to stay home. It was then that I noticed Mr. Simpson was carrying a square iron box filled with hot coals for the comfort of Mrs. Simpson's feet. As soon as Father began his sermon, I saw Mr. Simpson slump down in his seat, and I knew that Mr. Trowbridge, the tithing man, saw Mr. Simpson too. Mr. Trowbridge carried a long stick in his hand, as he did at every church service. The stick had a brass knob on one end. Mr. Trowbridge walked about the church during the services to make sure no one went to sleep. I saw him come towards Mr. Simpson. Suddenly there was a loud wham as the brass knob was brought down on Mr. Simpson's head. Blinking his eyes, Mr. Simpson jumped to his feet. He shouted, "Stand still!" And then, grabbing his wife by her shoulders, he began to shake her. "Wake up, Henry," Mrs. Simpson shouted at him. "I'm not one of your sheep, I'm your wife. You're not shearing sheep, you're listening to Reverend Smith's sermon." There were giggles all around. All eyes were on the Simpsons. Even Father stopped speaking for the moment. I wanted to giggle too, but I knew the pastor's daughter should not show merriment at such an awkward time. Mrs. Simpson was blushing a strawberry red. She took little Hannah's hand and pushed her husband out of the pew. I remember hearing something clatter when Mrs. Simpson left the pew. A little later, when I was back home, I happened to look out the window and I saw Mr. Simpson ride up to the meeting house in his wagon. I thought maybe he was looking for the tithing man and that maybe he was going to hit him because the tithing man had given him such a big whack. But I decided that wasn't why Mr. Simpson had come back to the meeting house. He wouldn't fight with Mr. Trowbridge on the Lord's Day. At dinner, as soon as prayers were said, I told Father about Mr. Simpson. Hannah Simpson said the reason Mr. Trowbridge hit her father so hard was because Mr. Simpson caught him cheating on wool weight when he sold his wool to Mr. Trowbridge. Father looked at me. He was serious. He said, "You should speak no evil of anyone, Abigail. Even if you know evil to be true, you should not repeat it." I felt ashamed. Father had told me before not to gossip. I said no more. Then Mother and Father talked of a new meeting house, which was to be built at once, everyone in the congregation contributing his share of goods and services. But I wondered during the next few days what Mr. Simpson had been doing at the meeting house after services. On the day when the whole town gathered to start building the new meeting house, Paul Torrey, the schoolmaster, told Father, "I believe I know who started the fire." "Do you have proof?" Father asked. "Did you see anyone go near the meeting house after service?" I looked at Mr. Simpson, who was standing nearby. I wondered if he would admit he had been back after services. Mr. Simpson stepped forward. "I went back, Reverend Smith," he said. "I went back for our foot warmer." "That's correct, Reverend," the tithing man stepped forward too. "Mr. Simpson came to my house later for his foot warmer. I picked it up for him after the service. I knew it was my fault that he left in such a hurry and forgot the warmer." "How did you know Mr. Trowbridge had your foot warmer?" Father asked, turning his full gaze on Mr. Simpson. Mr. Simpson hurried to explain. "I didn't think about the foot warmer when I went to Mr. Trowbridge's house. I decided to go there because we had had a misunderstanding about my wool. I found out that I was wrong and he was right. I wanted to tell him so." Father turned his eyes on me when he said, "It is good to have two such righteous men in our congregation." I blushed. I knew Father was telling me that this was an example of what he'd been talking about, never to repeat evil. Still, I remembered the sound of something making a noise on the floor when Mrs. Simpson pushed Mr. Simpson out of the pew. After lessons the next morning, I told Father but I still wasn't sure that the noise I had heard wasn't the warmer being turned over. "No one is sure," nodded Father. In a thoughtful vein, he continued, "Mr. Simpson might not have noticed coals smouldering when he came back after the service. He is a devout and kindly man. He would be deeply grieved if he thought he could have set fire to the meeting house." We had a long silence as we pondered together. Then Father said, "However, I must write an account of the fire in the record book, and I shall." Father wrote, "Weymouth Meeting House took fire April 23, 1751. Burned to the ground in 2 hours. 3 barrels of gunpowder, the town stock, blew up with great noise. Uncertain how it happened." As Father closed the record book, I thought the incident of the meeting house fire was shut away. But in a few years it was to be thought about again at a most unusual time and place. Chapter 3. I knew my life was going to change from hearing Mother and Father talking. I was at the window at the far end of our wide, sweet-smelling kitchen, slicing apples for pies. Mother and Father were alone at the table, which was unusual. At the parsonage there was always someone around who had dropped in. Many came from long distances with their families and had to be fed and put up for the night. Mother and Father were always busy taking care of people's needs in our home. It was one of the ways they had of doing God's work. My parents were a living example of a Bible verse I had heard. "Be ye kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you." Ephesians 4:32. "All our extra visitors have made a lot of work," Father said, settling himself at the kitchen table. "Phoebe and I couldn't begin to do all the work ourselves," Mother said. "We've put too much on Abigail." I wanted to interrupt and say that I didn't mind. In fact, I liked all the comings and goings of people who brought news of what was going on outside of Weymouth. "Abigail has never complained," Mother was quick to add. "She's helped with the cooking and dishwashing and baking most willingly." "And serving food and looking after smaller children," Father added. "But there hasn't been enough time for Nabby's lessons." Father looked worried. "And certainly no time for talk about manners," Mother nodded. She too looked worried. "Abigail's getting too thin. Her health has never been good. She's had colds every winter and an occasional bout of rheumatism too." It was customary to talk about my health. I was slightly built and only 5'2" tall. I looked smaller than that when standing near Mother or Mary. They were large women with heavy set shoulders and thick forearms. Even my younger brother Billy was already taller than me. I looked out the window where Billy's colt was kicking up his heels in the pasture and thought, "Size has nothing to do with strength. Billy's colt looks delicate. Still, he's strong like me. I can race all the way up Burying Hill and back and not be out of breath." Father was up on his feet, pacing the kitchen thoughtfully. Then he said, "There is reason to be concerned about Nabby. I didn't want to tell you, but there is a health problem here in Weymouth." "What health problem?" I blurted out before Mother did. "A terrible throat disease has broken out," Father said. "It is a strange malady. It doesn't seem to come to grown people, but children get the disease. Some are dying of it." "Oh," cried Mother. It was easy to see she was startled by the news, the way her eyes widened and her voice quivered. "Ben has it," Father said. "The Simpson's daughter has it too." "Then Abigail is sure to take it," Mother cried, "with a history of consumption in the Quincy family." "It's best we should send Nabby to your mother's," Father decided. "Tom will take her in the morning." At that minute, I finished peeling apples and began to think about packing. Just think, Grandmother Quincy's. Remembering the sea chest in the attic, I decided to fill it with presents for Grandmother. "Mary, Mary," I called, running up the stairs, "help me get the sea chest." "Why, Nabby, what do you want the chest for?" Mary ran out of her room and followed close behind me. "I'm going to Braintree to visit Grandmother Quincy."
Part 2.
We finally got the chest in our room, and I ran out to the barn and got a sack of straw and one of bran and a bag of cracked corn. Mother followed me upstairs, and when she saw the 3 sacks on the bed, she doubled up with laughter. "Why, "Are my presents for Grandmother funny?" I asked. "Because, dear Nabby, Grandmother has no need of these. She has all the grain she needs in her big barn. You don't have to take presents," Mother explained. "You always take presents when you go for a visit," I said, feeling a little hurt and confused. "When you go to Boston to visit Aunt Elizabeth, you take boxes and boxes of things." "Aunt Elizabeth lives in a town. She doesn't have farm food, so I take her sausages, butter and other produce that it's hard for her to get in fresh in Boston." Mary cut in. "Mother gets pins, spices, dyes and fabrics from Aunt Elizabeth. Remember, things we don't have in the country." But Mother let me take the sea chest and Mary helped me pile my petticoats and Sunday dresses into it. I packed my new shoes and a bonnet and shawl along with my nightgowns. "I still want to take Grandmother a present," I told Mary as we packed. "Take her the sampler you just finished, Nabby," Mary suggested. "It's a lovely sampler," Mother smiled. "There is not one misplaced or poorly worked stitch in it." I wasn't sure it was nice enough for Grandmother Quincy's mansion, but since Mary and Mother thought it was so nice, it was placed on top of my things in the chest. That night, before cuddling between the homespun flannel sheets that Mother and I had woven, I prayed to the Lord to help me please Grandmother and that my visit to Braintree would be a happy one. I thought, "All things whatsoever you shall ask in prayer believing, ye shall receive." Matthew 21:22. I lapsed into sweet sleep and dreamed of all the boys and girls I would meet at Braintree and the parties I would go to and the trips to Boston I would take. But most of all, I dreamed about Grandfather Quincy's library with all his books to read. In my dreams, I saw Grandmother, her smile, her soft laugh, her elegant manners. It was the rattle of the cart and Tom's talking to the team below my window that wakened me the next morning. Mother called, "Nabby, Tom's ready with the team hitched and the sea chest strapped on. Quickly, child, breakfast is ready." I threw back the covers and wriggled into my clothes. This was the day to make my trip to Mount Wollaston. Soon it was time. Father lifted me up to the seat. He called to the horses and down the hill we went. A salty breeze almost pushed the words back into my mouth as I called goodbye to all the neighbours. I saw Ben at his window and waved. "Please get well," I called. He nodded, but I knew he couldn't hear me. "You ought to be more careful, miss," Tom said. It was then I realized that the way I was jumping up and down and waving wildly and calling out goodbyes wasn't being ladylike. Mother would most certainly disapprove. I sat down. From then on, I bowed and nodded very nicely to all my other friends who were waving their goodbyes. It was a lovely day, a salty day, a God's blessing day. The road was dry, and knowing every twist and curve in it, I knew we'd turn and come along the seashore. Soon I heard the gentle waves, their lips kissing the shore. I saw a flick of red-winged bird and heard the gulls' harsh calls. The 4 miles to Grandmother's rolled by and soon we came to the Quincy Acres. I waved to the men working in Grandfather's stone quarry. Several of the men called out, "Welcome to Mount Wollaston, Miss Nabby." Towering above us was Grandmother's house on the hill, and Tom pulled at the reins as we turned into the lane. It was the first time I had ever come here alone, and I felt grown up and very important. Grandfather and Grandmother were waiting for me on the front steps. As soon as the cart stopped, Grandfather lifted me down, and Grandmother opened her arms to me. I hugged and kissed her. Then Grandfather said, "See here, young lady, I have a kiss or two for you, too." "There is a present for you, Grandmother," I said as soon as we were in the entryway. "There were lots of things to bring you, but Mother said you didn't need them." Lifting the chest lid, I took out the sampler. Grandmother's eyes widened, and a pretty smile curved her lips. "I am pleased, Abigail," she said. "The sampler is beautifully done, dear, and what's important is that you wanted to give something of yourself, something in which you gave effort and time. This I appreciate." Grandmother put the sampler on the candle table in the entryway where everyone would see it. Closing the lid on the chest, we followed Tom as he carried it up the stairs. Grandmother sat near the window of the cheerful room that was to be mine during my visit at Wollaston. As I continued to unpack, Being busy made it easier to tell Grandmother what really worried me. "It's going to be hard to remember not to run or skip or jump," I said, "and I don't like being out of things." "What things?" Grandmother asked. "I don't like not knowing what's going on in the world until the men tell me. I didn't even know when Governor Shirley of our colony was recalled to England last September. But Mother says it's not important to know. Women do not take as active a part in the outside world as men," Grandmother told me. "But women do Christian deeds that are as great as the deeds men do. You will see how much good you can do in the world if you watch and listen to what goes on about you." After I unpacked, I ran out to play on the wide green lawns that sloped down to the sea. The salt air made me want to breathe deeply. It was as if God was filling me with strength. The next morning at breakfast, I asked Grandmother when we would be meeting some of the boys and girls of Braintree. I was anxious to meet new people, especially those who knew what was happening in the world. "When you learn to be a fine hostess, Abigail," Grandmother said, "we shall entertain." That afternoon, the maid set out the best tea things. Grandmother was dressed in one of her heavy silk dresses and wore a cap made of lace from across the sea. Grandmother poured tea into four cups, even though just the two of us sat there. She asked me to pass the cups around and then the cakes. I curtsied at each empty chair. I thought it was quite an elegant pretend party. Grandmother smiled when I was through practicing and said, "You did everything properly, Abby. Now you must keep practicing even when you go back home." "It won't be like this, Grandmother," I said. "We don't have china as fine as yours. We don't have a silver teapot." "The serving things are not as important as the way you serve," Grandmother said. "If you keep godly thoughts and pleasant manners, you could serve from a simple clay pot and still have a party. And now I shall invite some guests." Friends and relatives had noticed that I was a young lady now, and my little girl, Nabby, was gradually giving way to a grown-up sounding Abby. It was 2 days before the guests would arrive. Since Grandmother had many servants, there was no more work for me to do. I spent most of my time curled up in the big leather chair in the library, reading books. Then party day came. "Grandmother, what shall I do when I am presented?" "You must curtsy naturally and offer the gentleman your hand. Above all, dear, speak softly, for that is the first requirement of a lady," Grandmother said. "Who will be coming?" I asked. Grandmother studied the list lying on her writing desk. "A gentleman who was one time a neighbour, John Hancock. I've invited your cousin, Dorothy Quincy. Joseph Warren will be coming. Then there is John Adams, who is home for the summer holidays. He teaches at Worcester. He was at Harvard with the other boys." "Doesn't John Adams live in Braintree?" I asked, suddenly remembering that Father had spoken about him. "The Adams farm is about a mile from here," Grandmother nodded. "Is he going to be a minister?" I asked, thinking it was an intelligent question. Almost every New England family who had the money for higher education expected their oldest son to be a minister. Grandmother shook her head sadly. "No, I fear not," she said. "John Adams is foolishly studying law. He'll not amount to much that way, earning his fees by helping the dishonest. People in the colonies don't think much of lawyers." I wanted to disagree with Grandmother and point out to her that sometimes people are falsely accused and need a lawyer, but she was already laying out the tea things. The silver tea service gleamed on a small table, and Grandmother measured the tea and put a copper kettle on the fire. "When the guests are here, you may pass the plates of cakes, Nabby, as I pour the tea," Grandmother instructed. I watched Grandmother making ready for the company. She moved easily among the appointments of the drawing room. The rich silk of her full-skirted dress shimmered as she walked. In a few minutes there was the sound of horses' hoofs, and soon I was curtsying beside Grandmother and greeting our guests. My cousin Dorothy wasn't much older than me, but she knew more about being in male company. She had already had a proposal of marriage. She looked at the men with her dark eyes coyly, and yet intensely. The three men were more interesting to me than Dorothy. John Hancock, who lived in Boston, was thin and stooped and slightly nervous. His wig was elegant and was tied with a big black bow. His red velvet coat had large engraved buttons. Joseph Warren was still going to Harvard. He planned to be a doctor of medicine. But the man who interested me most was John Adams. He was the oldest of the three. He had beautiful blue eyes. He didn't wear a wig, but wore his light brown hair neatly combed. He was short and stocky, with shoulders that were broad and powerful. He talked more than the others, with a deep voice. When he laughed heartily. Just as one of John Adams' laughs died away, Grandfather Quincy strode into the room. He was smiling. "It is good news, sir?" asked John Hancock. Since Grandfather was interested in government and a colonel in the local militia, the young men looked to him for government news. "Our new Prime Minister in England, William Pitt, has sent us Lord Geoffrey Amherst. His ships are in Boston Harbour now." The English I knew wanted to move westward and take farmland on the other side of the mountains. But the French claimed the Mississippi Valley as well as land in Canada. The Indians were on the side of the French because they wanted this land for hunting. Father had said that the French and the English had been fighting for more than 50 years. Grandfather went on, "Wolfe is to move against Quebec, and Amherst is to go by way of Lake Champlain to Montreal, and then join Wolfe." "It will be good for the English to win," said John Adams. "When this war is over, we will not need England's protection any longer." How disloyal, I thought. "Why should we want to break away from England?" asked Grandfather. "We have the rights of all English-born people, and we have been prosperous and well cared for under English rule." "Her navigation laws hurt our trade," said John Adams. I thought, he is a very persistent person. He thinks his ideas are right. Grandfather likes him, even if he doesn't agree with him. I can see that. I like him, too. After the guests left, Grandfather said, "That John Adams is an unusual man." "In what way?" Grandmother asked. "Well, for example, as Adams left, I suggested that we talk too much politics, and that perhaps he would have been more interested in talking to the girls. You know what he said?" "I'm sure we have no idea," Grandmother said. "He said he expects to go to Boston soon to practice law, and that means he will have to give all his time to law. He said there was no room in his life for girls, guns, or cards," Grandfather said. Then Grandfather went on, "Adams told me that he wants a thinking woman, a reading woman. He said those are very scarce in New England." I smiled at that. Most girls never went beyond the dames' school. It was not fashionable to be educated. Perhaps I was the only girl in New England whose parents and grandparents had encouraged me to do a great deal of reading. Grandfather's voice came through my private thinking. He was saying, "Abby, don't you hear me? I asked you if you would like to accompany me to Boston tomorrow. You could visit some of the Smith relatives while I watch Lord Geoffrey Amherst land." "Oh, yes, Grandfather," I said in a voice I knew was too loud to please Grandmother. I was so excited my voice got loud before I realized it. But Grandmother said nothing. She did raise a reproving finger, though. Then she said, "We shall get you ready. You must rise at dawn, Abby." "Yes, Grandmother," I cried, and skipped from the room. Chapter 4. Boisterous Boston. The sun was up when Grandfather Quincy and I arrived at Boston. The wheels rattled over the cobblestone streets, and I watched country people in their wagons coming to Boston to sell their berries and pumpkins. "Look at all the ships," I cried, pointing toward the bay. "I've never seen so many ships at once." "Lord Amherst's ships are idling in the harbour. There is a whaling fleet in, too. And your Uncle Isaac's ship is in," Grandfather explained. Suddenly the coach stopped. It swayed crazily at the suddenness of the halt. As I looked out of the coach window, I gasped. Two sailors with rings in their ears and knives in their belts stood blocking the road. "Are they pirates, Grandfather?" "No, Abby," he said. "These men are sailors who have taken on some heathen ways."
"What is the meaning of this?"
Grandfather shouted to the men. Take your hands off my horses. I demand you to step aside. I was proud of my grandfather. My fear slipped away. His strong voice and his commanding attitude and his tall, vigorous body gave me strength. Oh, it is you, Colonel Quincy, said the taller man politely. We're from Isaac Smith's ships with orders from Mr. Smith not to let anyone loiter around the docks. They're unloading now, you see, sir. The cargo is a very expensive one. Mostly dyes, sir. Dyes are worth almost as much as gold, sir. Yes, yes, said Grandfather with an impatient wave of his hand. We rattled on. We'll get off at the end of the long wharf, Grandfather told the driver, Job. You may wait for me at the Crown. Long Wharf was 2,000 feet long, stretching into the sea. It was the longest wharf in Boston. Ships of all kinds were anchored on the south side. There were whalers, merchants' vessels, small fishing boats, and ships of the King's Navy. On the north side of the wharf were warehouses, shops, and counting houses. I sniffed the air. It smelled different from the air at Weymouth. At Weymouth, a breeze smelling of clover and rich earth. Here, the smells came from dried fish, leather, lumber, salted meats. Over all, the heavy odor of molasses hung with sweet stickiness. Grandfather explained that the molasses had come from the West Indies. It would be made into rum in the colonies. Then the rum would be exchanged for slaves. After our long, windy walk, we came to the place where Uncle Isaac Smith's ship was docked. The crew was working as fast as they could, hoisting goods from the hold of the ship. Some sailors were loading wheelbarrows and moving them down the gangplank and up the street to the warehouse. They were having a hard time pushing the wheelbarrows, for the streets were crowded now, and the sailors had to manoeuvre the wheelbarrows between the people. The townspeople had come to see the troops land. I was pushed and shoved. I wondered how I'd ever get to see the landing. Then a tall man came out of one of the warehouses and, after bowing slightly, said, Colonel Quincy, I'd be honoured if you and your charming granddaughter would come to the second story of my warehouse. You can view the landing of His Gracious Majesty's troops from there. Grandfather nodded and bid me follow him. He walked with such big steps that I had to take two or three steps to his one. I followed Grandfather to the warehouse and up the narrow steps to the second floor. I was relieved that I was going to be able to see the landing. Leaning out the window, I could see Boston Harbour and all the patchwork of roofs which ran to the water's edge. Outlined against the blue sky were the tall hills of Boston. There was Fort Hill on the south, Beacon Hill in the middle, and Copse Hill on the north. Then the bells began to ring so loudly I covered my ears. Grandfather pulled my hands down ever so gently as he said, Abby, I want you to hear the drums and the whistles of the fight. This is a proud day for us Englishmen. I did listen and look. Lines of uniformed men with their long-tailed red coats and their white breeches passed by the warehouse. The officers rode well-groomed horses. At the end of the marching men was Lord Geoffrey Amherst, riding on a large bay. As he passed the warehouse, he took off his plumed hat and doffed it toward the cheering crowd. A cheer came to my throat, too, and I shouted, Hurrah! Hurrah! I was proud to be English. I thought it was grand to have these trained troops defend the colonies against the French and the Indians. I thought for a fleeting moment about John Adams and how ungrateful he was towards the mother country. It's wonderful to be English, I told Grandfather. In my mind, I was talking to John Adams. Yes, indeed, agreed Grandfather. But we cannot linger here any longer. Uncle Isaac and Aunt Elizabeth will be expecting you. We must be on our way. Uncle Isaac and Aunt Elizabeth's house was almost as elegant as grandmother's. It was on top of Copse Hill, and from the generous windows I could see 10 or more shipyards. I could hear the sound of hammers and saws. The smell of paint wafted up from the yards. Boston was an exciting place. My room was wide and pleasant. Aunt Elizabeth sent servants to open my bed. They brought me fresh milk to drink. They arranged flowers in my room and laid out the clothes I was to wear. Aunt Elizabeth, I would be spoiled if I stayed here in Boston for very long. Nonsense, child, she stroked my hair with her jewelled hand. "You've always been a delicate child, Abby. You could do with a little spoiling. Despite your frequent illnesses, you've grown to be a very pretty young lady. The young men in Boston will be coming to call." Her remark made me think about John Adams, and then I felt a blush warm my cheeks. But Aunt Elizabeth hadn't noticed. She was busy hanging up clothes and smoothing the sheets of the huge four-poster bed. The next morning, Grandfather woke me even before the vendors on the street began calling out their wares. "We have a big day ahead, child," he said. "We must stop at Paul Revere's for a teapot he is making for your grandmother. And I do want to take this opportunity to go aboard Isaac's ship." Job, Grandfather's driver, was ready at the door, and we drove through the steep North End street until we came near the head of Clark's Wharf. We stopped in front of a dark brown house with small paned windows. The smell of charcoal was strong in the shop. The man sitting at the bench looked up and smiled as he said, "Good morning, Colonel Quincy. And this young lady with you looks like a Quincy, too. Am I correct in addressing her as Miss Quincy?" "May I present my granddaughter Abigail Smith," Grandfather said, and I felt he was proud to introduce me. I curtsied as Grandmother had taught me and looked into Paul Revere's dark eyes. He had dark skin and a wide mouth. He wasn't a tall man, but he was a sturdy man. I remembered Grandmother had said he was of French descent and that his ancestors had come to America to escape religious persecution, much as our ancestors had come from England for the same reason. "Do you have my wife's silver piece ready?" Grandfather asked. "Yes, sir," said Paul Revere. "I finished it quickly, for I knew you'd be here today because of Lord Amherst's arrival. I believe with you, sir, that Amherst and Wolfe will conquer the French, and that will be the end of this long and tedious conflict." A fish peddler went by, at that moment blowing his tin horn, and I didn't hear what further political opinion that Grandfather gave. Grandfather paid Mr. Revere for the teapot, and we went back to the carriage. Job drove us to Uncle Isaac's warehouse. Since Uncle Isaac was a wealthy merchant, he had the time and leisure to spend with Grandfather and me. At Uncle Isaac's warehouse, there was a mixture of smells that my nose had never sniffed before. They tingled my imagination. Their aromas spoke to me of faraway places. There was a smell of nutmegs and ginger. I could smell coffee, too. We walked through sawdust, spilled on the floor as fine porcelains and china dishes were unpacked from wooden boxes. The workmen called the sawdust bran, and things that were shipped in this bran were called brand new. "And now," said Uncle Isaac, "would you like to visit one of my ships?" "Oh, yes," I told him, looking up into his kindly face. "I've never been on board a ship before." We walked under the elms towards the wharf. I paused and waited for a gold thrush to break the calm. His notes swelled into a triumphant psalm. The men paid little attention to my skipping and hopping as I followed them. It wasn't ladylike, but I was so excited about boarding a ship that I couldn't stand still. Grandfather was saying, "Once Quebec falls, all our strife will be over. All of Canada will belong to England." "Long live the King," said Uncle Isaac. At the wharf, a sailor helped us into a rowboat and rowed us to one of the ships anchored in the harbour. When we came to the ship, the sailor helped me to put my foot on the first rung of a rope ladder that was hanging over the side of the ship. I was afraid. The ladder swayed in the breeze and didn't look strong enough to support even my small weight. But Uncle Isaac and Grandfather nodded for me to climb. Taking a deep breath, I did. It was easy once I got started. On board, the captain greeted us warmly. "Let me take you to my quarters," he said. His cabin was small, with a bunk on one side and a great table on the other. The table was covered with maps, charts, quills, ink, and small tools. Then back on deck, we watched some of the sailors climb the ship's rigging. Sailors were swabbing decks, others were pushing barrels of cargo. They yelled to each other, and evil words sputtered from their mouths like sparks from a roaring fire. "Grandfather," I whispered. Grandfather bent down to hear me better. "Grandfather," I said, "these are foul men." "No, dear," Grandfather whispered back, "many of them have not had the opportunity to hear the Lord's word. They do not know the words they use are sinful. How sad, I cried. I shall pray for them, Grandfather. As shall I, he said. The ship was rocking ever so slightly. The rocking bothered me. My stomach began churning. I felt dizzy too. Please, may we go back to shore now, I asked. Uncle Isaac patted my head sympathetically. Now, now, Abby, he said, don't let a little uneasiness make you want to abandon the sea. Some day you will take a long voyage across the ocean, so you must accept and enjoy the rolling of the sea. I don't think I ever will, I said, as the churning in my stomach grew worse. Of course, on this day I had no way of knowing that Uncle Isaac's prediction that I would some day take an ocean voyage would indeed come true. The swooping seagulls shrieked above us as we were rowed to shore. It was with gratefulness that I felt solid land under my feet once more. The weathered face of Boston bid us welcome. This visit to Grandmother Quincy's was over, but I knew there would be many more exciting ones. Chapter 5. John Adams. As the next 4 years went by, I made many trips to Boston and to Grandmother Quincy's. Grandmother and I were kindred souls. Grandmother, too, had taken Christ as her Saviour. She loved God and admired common sense. She liked to laugh also. One day when I was at Grandmother's, Mrs. Tittle, of whom Grandmother was not specially fond, came for tea. I assisted with serving as usual. The maid handed me a tray of freshly baked cherry tarts. They smelled deliciously of butter and cherries and almonds. Mrs. Tittle was talking rapidly and vehemently about being loyal to the crown. She waved her hands expressively. Even the long, elegant feather which was attached to her imported cap waved about as she nodded and jerked her head to emphasize the points of loyalty she was making. I was so fascinated by Mrs. Tittle's movements, I neglected to watch my tarts. When I did glance at the tarts, I gasped silently at what I saw. Mrs. Tittle's feather was dragging back and forth across the tarts, absorbing the red, bubbling cherry juices. Grandmother appeared not to notice. She gave her full attention to the very verbal Mrs. Tittle. When at last I escorted Mrs. Tittle to the door, I hurried back into Grandmother's sitting room to apologize. Something in the twinkling lights in Grandmother's eyes made me pause to study her pretty face. Then Grandmother said, "Now Mrs. Tittle has not only a tart tongue, but she has a tart feather as well." I could not hold back the laughter. Grandmother threw back her head and her deep-throated laugh joined mine. In fact, we laughed to such an extent that Grandfather Quincy left his study to investigate the cause of such merriment. There were other pleasures at Grandmother's, too. We read and talked about the Bible together. The large collection of books at Wollaston were all mine to enjoy. I read the histories of England and prayed every night for the King and the royal family. I read the works of Shakespeare and Pope. Grandmother gave me British periodicals. The Spectator contained witty essays written in a fine style which we read and talked about together. I made these my literary model. There were many books on religion which influenced my writing and thinking too. Grandmother and Grandfather's house was always filled with boys and girls from the neighbourhood who came on horseback or in horse-drawn sulkies, chaises, or in winter, sleighs. We always had fun at Wollaston, playing games or having long discussions of poetry, history, literature, art, and Jesus Christ's ministry. If weather or sickness kept us home, there was always the chance to communicate by letters. Many of my friends signed their letters with pen names taken from mythology or from the classics. I always signed my letters Diana. There was a constant exchange of letters with boys and girls, but never with a sweetheart. Many of my friends were getting married, but few men called on me. Mary said it was because men were afraid of a girl who was so much better educated than they were. Mary knew about these things. She was engaged to Richard Cranch. One evening early in October, while Mary was waiting for Richard, I murmured my thoughts out loud to her. I'm 17, old enough to be married. smoothing my hands over the old brown calico which I had made myself and stroking my hair, which were swept back like two wings on either side of my face, I waited for Mary's consoling words. "You're so lovely, Abby," Mary said. "You move with grace and dignity. Grandmother Quincy should be proud to know how well her teaching has taken effect." Just then there was a knock. "It's Richard," cried Mary. She was still arranging her hair before the mirror. "Please let Richard in." I wasn't looking neat enough to receive visitors, but Mary was so excited and happy I couldn't deny her request. Mary was in love with Richard Cranch, who was an English-born gentleman. He was as tall as Mary and almost as broad-shouldered. He was in partnership with other manufacturers to corner the spermaceti whale oil market. Richard had been very generous with me, bringing me books of poetry by Gray, Dryden, Milton and Pope. Mary's mood was so infectious that I felt giddy too. Dancing down the stairs, I practically pirouetted toward the door. I opened it, giving my deepest courtesy. "Welcome, Sir Richard," I said, suppressing a giggle. Then I saw that Richard was not alone. John Adams was with him. A rush of blood warmed my cheeks. "Oh, Mr. Adams," I stammered as Mary came down the stairs. She helped the men off with their coats, stowing them in the entry closet under the stairs. I dropped, disgusted with myself, onto the hard wooden bench outside the library door. It was surprising to me that John Adams should cause me so much embarrassment. I knew I would have laughed at my foolishness had it been any other young man. As I looked up at John Adams with his plump cheeks and strong, stocky figure, my feelings towards him puzzled me. He was the exact opposite of the two men I loved and admired most, my father and my uncle-cousin Dr. Cotton Tufts. They were both tall, lean and spare men. My father came to the library door and said, "Come into my study, John." "I'll bring some apples," I said. Placing the apples in a bowl, my thoughts were still completely taken with John Adams. Why, I wondered, did he make me feel so shy? I had known him ever since I was a little girl. He lived just 4 miles away on a farm at Braintree. He had graduated from Harvard, taught school, and now he was getting started as a lawyer. There was nothing about him that should make me tongue-tied. As I entered Father's study with a bowl of apples, I wished I had worn something prettier than the old brown calico. "These are apples from a tree Father and I planted together one day when I was a little girl. I've nurtured the tree in our house yard myself," I said. John Adams' eyes widened. I suppose he was surprised because most girls weren't interested in horticulture. Having heard that he was interested in fruit trees and everything else on his farm, I thought our apple tree worth mentioning. When I saw his immediate interest, I knew why his friends called him Farmer John. John Adams came back again and again. He always seemed to be calling on Father. They had long discussions about politics and Samuel Adams and James Otis, who spoke out against the writs of assistance in the Supreme Court. As spring came to Weymouth, the talk of England's injustices continued, but the glorious New England green-up time lured everyone away from serious thought and took them outdoors. One day, Mary and Richard asked me and John Adams to accompany them on a picnic. "You're too delicate for a boat ride," Mother said. "I'm not sure." On that picnic Saturday morning, I woke up early with quivering excitement. I slipped downstairs to find Phoebe was already at the storage porch preparing the picnic lunch. The oaken tub was filled with bath water and awaiting me. With bayberry soap and white flannel cloth, I scrubbed myself glowingly clean. Phoebe had my towel in the baking oven to warm. I stood on the oval, wool-braided rug just long enough to dry, and then draping the towel around myself, I made a quick run through the dining room to the sitting room and would have run upstairs when I heard loud voices in the study. I heard Mother ask, "Why are you so friendly with John Adams?" I stopped short in the hallway. This was the first time I had ever heard my parents discuss John Adams. Should I eavesdrop, I wondered. My conscience told me no, but my curiosity told me, stay. Father said, "It is time Nabby had friends. now that Mary is engaged. Mother said, he's the son of a farmer and he's a lawyer. Lawyers are justly held in low esteem. Their only purpose is to help wrongdoers. I ran up the stairs and almost collided with Mary as she came down the stairs for her bath. What's wrong? Mary asked. You're pale and your eyes are flashing like beacons from the lighthouse. The words flowed from me. Poor Mary stood flabbergasted as I poured out my defense of John Adams to her. I said, of course John comes from a long line of farmers. He's had a college education at Harvard where he distinguished himself. He's a fine Christian. His father wanted him to go into the church, but he had no leading of God. His friends knew his powers of argument were great and persuaded him that the law was his proper profession. To support himself while he was studying, he taught school. Mary, does this not prove him to be a serious, good young man? Yes, yes, Mary cried, wide-eyed and startled. Mother doesn't want me to go with you and Richard, I went on. I can't tell which she objects to more, Mr. Adams or the boat. Mary put her hand on my arm. I'll speak to Mother. I'll tell her you'll wear your wool stockings and your gallows shoes to protect yourself from taking ill. It'll be all right, you'll see. The men rowed the boat to Rainsford Island. Mary and I sat together in the bow. John Adams was quiet. He seemed to be enjoying the exercise. Richard Cranch talked to a rhythm to the oar strokes. He talked mostly about cogwheels and pumps. Soon they beached the boat and we spread Phoebe's picnic lunch on a flat boulder set on a circle of marsh rosemary. John lingered long over the chicken and cider and johnny cake while Mary and Richard went in search of seashells. Finally John spread his coat on the bank and I sat down on his coat. Gulls cawed and screamed above us. The sea was beautiful that day. God's perfect creation. John seemed like a proper part of the scene, especially his eyes. They were like the sea. They were deep blue, except when he was opposed to something. Then his eyes were grey like the clouds that hung over the water. His eyes looked almost purple when he was angry. A moody man, this John Adams. He was as moody as the sea. He was talking about the law. Suddenly he turned and looked deep into my eyes. He said, I admire the law, Miss Abigail Smith. Law is human reason. Law is justice. It guarantees our rights. Yes, I agree, Mr. Adams, I nodded. And does it take all your time to study the law? I have other pursuits as well, he said. What do you do with your time? I asked. His eyes grew big and blue as he said, I gallant the girls. I stared at him unbelievingly. I had never heard that John Adams was a man who enjoyed the company of many ladies, and then the humour of it struck me. Of course it was well known that Mr. Adams had little time or interest in courting. A laugh chortled in my throat. Then we both burst into loud and boisterous laughter. That wasn't true, you know, he said between laughs. Soon Mary and Richard came back with their shells and turned back to the boat. A wind was whipping itself up from the south. John took off his coat and wrapped it around me. It was the next evening when I learned from Richard that John had come down with a cold. I felt responsible since I had worn his coat. I decided to talk to Cousin Cotton. Cousin Cotton was really a double relative. He was an uncle by marriage on my mother's side and a blood cousin on my father's side. He was Weymouth's doctor. A bell tinkled as I opened his front door. Cousin Cotton, I greeted him. His big lips parted into a pleasant smile as he looked up from his workbench where he was grinding herbs with a stone pestle. His kindly brown eyes focused on me as they adjusted to the flickering candlelight. Cousin, do you have a cure for a cold? I asked. Who has a cold? John Adams. John Adams? Cousin Cotton's mouth gaped open. He was overheated from rowing. He took off his coat when a wind came up and gave it to me. Well, 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 laughed Cousin Cotton. That's the first time I've ever heard anything gallant and romantic about John Adams. What do you prescribe, Doctor? Tell your Mr. Adams to go to bed for a day with a volume of Herodotus, strong beef broth, and a jug of Barbados rum. Between the three, nature will cure him. He's not my Mr. Adams. He will not take rum. He told me yesterday of an article he wrote against taverns and rum drinking, I told the doctor. Then I shall have to call on him and take him some herb medicine, said Cousin Cotton. Thank you, I said, and left hurriedly because I was becoming embarrassed by Cousin Cotton's grin when he mentioned John Adams. On the following Sunday, I saw John at church and he seemed perfectly well. I hoped he would talk to me, but he left church with the Tuftses. It was a disappointment. But perhaps he'd come to tea, I consoled myself. On Sunday, tea was always served at the Reverend Smith's parsonage. Usually there were 40 or more parishioners attending. Father led beautiful devotions, and Mother presided over the tea table with pleasure. Just as I had hoped, I saw John as he approached our house. I had never seen him so well dressed before. His wig was powdered and brushed and gathered neatly behind his ears. He wore a white linen collar, a coat and a vest of wool adorned with embossed buttons. "Thank you, Miss Abigail," he said, striding up to me with strong, even steps. "Thank you for sending me that cold remedy. It is my expression of love of the Lord to help the afflicted," I told him. "I am pleased to help others in his name." I saw John Adams frequently after that. One day he asked me to marry him. I thought I'd burst with excitement, but when he asked permission to speak to Father alone, I saw my mother's expression tighten. Her jaws set into a straight, thin line. She told me it was time for me to retire. What a restless night it was. Would Father give his consent? Did Father not always say I must have a mind of my own? If that were so, and I knew in my mind as well as in my heart that I loved John, should I not insist that Father give his consent? I prayed fervently that the Lord would see fit to bless our union. It was not until after breakfast the next morning that Father talked about the interview with John Adams. "He has asked permission to marry you, Abigail," Father said. "He's only a lawyer," Mother said. "His father is only a country farmer." "I consider him a brilliant young man," Father said. "I am convinced that he will do well with his future." Then Father turned to me and asked, "How do you feel about John Adams, Abigail?" "I love him," I said, and felt warm colour come to my cheeks. My heart was pounding with happiness. Father was on my side. Father liked John. "Then I shall tell John he may continue to call on you," Father said. He glanced at Mother as if to tell her that his word was final. Mother raised her chin high. "There will be no talk of marriage for a long time," she said quietly but firmly. "Abigail isn't strong enough, and Mary must be married first." Chapter 6. Mrs. John Adams. I tried to make up to John for all the coolness he met at my home. I wrote him letters when he was away, riding the circuit of the courts. All of Weymouth talked about my suitor. Phoebe said, "People is saying you're courting below your station, Miss Nabby." When John wasn't riding the circuit, he came over from Braintree 2 evenings a week, and on Saturday nights stayed with Cotton Tufts. One day Father and I were alone in the study. Father said, "My dear Abby, I have something to say to you. I know it is not easy to wait like this for the proper time for your wedding, but if your love is true, you will wait. From a lifetime of reading Scripture, I have come to believe that true love is God's will, and therefore worth waiting for." I felt the tears well up behind my eyelids as I said, "Thank you, Father. You have made the waiting a little easier." I trusted that the Lord knew best.
Part 3.
As the days went on, I used them for preparing for the time when I would be Mrs. Adams. I learned to dip candle wicks and make soap from grease and wood ash. Mother helped me improve my technique of spinning flax and wool. Phoebe showed me how to make pickling fluids for purple cabbage, green walnuts and fish. The making of rich fruit preserves was carefully learned. Tom showed me how to get quills for pens. Father trained me in salting cod and smoking ham and venison. In the fall, I was caught up in the weeks of getting ready for Mary's wedding. Father's wedding sermon was based on Luke 10:42. Mary hath chosen that good part which shall not be taken away from her. The wedding reception at the parsonage was one of the biggest Weymouth had ever seen. There were over 100 Quincys, Nortons and Smiths from just about every part of Massachusetts. And then, of course, there were the dear friends in the church's congregation and the deacons and the elders and selectmen. Phoebe and Tom were in charge of the 11 serving girls who brought in trays and trays of smoked meat and game birds. John Adams came to the parsonage with cotton tuts. John and my cousin seemed to be spending the afternoon keeping out of Mother's way and trying to save Mary from being kidnapped by the young men of Weymouth. I have learned of the plot to steal Mary, John whispered in my ear as we stepped into the house yard together. I was not surprised, for stealing the bride was a favourite game at Massachusetts weddings. If the young men got Mary to a neighbouring tavern, Richard would have to pay the bill. Mary would not be free to go on her honeymoon until the next day. How did you learn of it? I asked. I haven't time to tell you about that now. We must find Richard. You draw him aside and tell him to meet me by the apple tree, John said, looking scanningly about the grounds. I hurried back inside and found Richard going into the room where all the gentlemen were gathering. Pulling at his arm, I whispered, Richard, meet John by the apple tree at the house yard. He knows of a plan to abduct Mary. Richard shot me a grateful glance and slipped away towards the entry door. Richard and Mary were safely on their way to their new home in Germantown when the last guests parted. Mother came up to John, who lingered on to the end of the reception. Mr. Adams, Mother said, I wish to thank you for foiling the plot to abduct Mary. Your efforts in my daughter's behalf are most appreciated. John smiled. I knew he was thinking that maybe someday Mother would approve of him. He bowed ever so slightly and prepared to leave. I walked with him to where his horse was posted. When will I be going with you? I asked, looking up into the clear blue eyes. I am hoping by February, John said as he mounted his horse and rode away. But in February there was an outbreak of smallpox. Dr. Cotton Tuft said this epidemic looked as if it would be as bad as the one that had broken out in 1721, when more than half the population of Boston came down with the disease and many died. It was while John and I were having dinner with Cousin Cotton and Aunt Lucy when Dr. Cotton Tuft made an announcement. An epidemic in Boston could easily be carried to Weymouth and Braintree. We go to Boston often. We could bring the disease here. We must be inoculated. There are two private hospitals in Boston being opened, and I suggest we take the full treatment. What about me? I asked. Women don't get inoculated, Abby. Hospitals are only for men, Cousin Cotton explained. John was frowning. Riding the circuit, I need protection. Right now I have two cases which have to be settled. I could take the inoculation by the middle of February. How long does the treatment take? About 4 weeks in the hospital. 2 or 3 more weeks at home to gain back strength and seeing no one. Smallpox can be contagious even during its last days. My hands lay quietly in my lap, but I was counting on my fingers how long it would be before I saw John again. John was looking up at the ceiling as if he was counting too. As our eyes met, it was as if we were saying to each other, it will be the middle of April before we see each other again. Days wore by. I wrote to John and waited eagerly for his letters. He wrote his reaction to the inoculation. A short shivering fit, a succeeding hot glowing fit, a want of appetite. As for the pox themselves, he said in another letter, about 8 or 10, 2 of which are on my face and the rest scattered at random over my limbs and body. One day, just before John left Boston, I was in my bedroom writing to him when Mother's soft knock at my door and her quiet entrance surprised me. Mother did not usually interrupt me when I was in my room. "Tell Mr. Adams he has my good wishes for his safety," she said. This was the closest Mother had ever come to accepting John. It made me so happy I jumped up and threw my arms around her and, kissing her, exclaimed, "You are kind, Mother. I love you." Mother smiled. "I love you too, dear. You must know that what I do out of love." It was almost summer before John left his mother's house in Braintree. That first day when he came to the parsonage, he was bursting with good health and vigour. "Miss Adorable," he said to me, cupping my chin in his hand, "let's begin our wedding preparations at once. I'll select the heavy furniture in Boston for your approval, and you get busy assembling whatever it is you feel you must have." "What date did you have in mind, John?" I asked quietly, though I felt boisterously happy. "Late October would be suitable, I think," John said. "We'll have everything we need to make a start by then." "Yes, John," I said. It was almost 3 years since John had proposed marriage, and now, with Mother's blessing, wedding plans were being made. Mother helped me to get my pewter tableware, glasses, bowls, silver mugs, a spinning wheel, a skillet on legs, and irons and bellows. John said it was hard to get furniture and other goods. Goods from England were not plentiful because England and the colonies were not on the best of terms. Parliament had passed the Sugar Act, and the colonists did not like it. People in Massachusetts refused to buy anything grown or manufactured in England. It was difficult to buy brass and copper kettles because there were no good American kettles made. But John and I gathered enough goods for our start in life together, and our wedding day, October 25, 1764, dawned bright as the fall foliage. I was 20, and John was 29. We were married in the parlour of the parsonage. It was not the big wedding that Mary had. Relatives were not so impressed with John Adams, the farmer's son, as they had been with Richard Cranch, the successful businessman of good family. But the parlour was gay with autumn fruits and foliage. My heart sang a hymn of thanksgiving to the Lord for giving me John. I prayed God would bless our marriage. I wore a red and white sprigged woolen dress, and I had a bright new cloak for going away. John was in dark blue broadcloth and had white satin waistcoat embroidered by his mother in gold thread with sprays of wheat. Father performed the wedding service. His voice was never more vibrant than that day. When the wedding feast was over, John lifted me onto his big brown mare. I rode with him towards our new home. Judah, the negro servant Mother had loaned us, rode in a cart with a chest of linen and woolen goods that I had made. "This is our home," John said when we came to a small house facing the high road in Braintree. We dismounted and walked to the green slope of Penn's Hill across the road. "You can watch the ocean from the top of this hill," he said. "On a clear day you can see a great distance, almost to Boston." "Father told me that the original two-room cabin had been built on this spot in 1680, I said, scanning the house and the countryside eagerly. "Several additions had now been made to it. This was to be our home, our farm." North of our house was another house which looked almost like it. It was the house where John had been born. John's mother and younger brothers, Peter and Elihu, lived there now. The two houses were almost alike. Both were slope-roofed cottages. They were built of clapboards, which had turned greyish-brown. "I know I'll be happy here," I told John. As we walked into the house, I was mentally arranging all my things. The house was built around with a very large central chimney with a huge fireplace and deep ovens. There was a long sloping roof above the kitchen, and there was a narrow stairway to the upper floor. "And I have a parlour, and you have an office for your law clients," I exclaimed happily. In the days that followed, I saw how much John loved his farm, a 9-acre tract of land. He did most of the work himself, though his law practice was growing and taking more and more of his time. John's mother and I became good friends, and we visited back and forth. I got on well with his brothers, too. Mary and Richard lived near us now at Salem. Mount Wollaston was a nice walk from our home. Grandma Quincy was still my favourite, and we had many long talks. I did not lack for good company. Grandfather Quincy was occupied with the new King George. He was a different type of king from George II. This George III was going to make the colonies contribute money whether they liked it or not. He put a tax on legal documents that had never been taxed before. Massachusetts refused to pay unless she was represented in Parliament. This new king would not have colonists in Parliament, and the Court of Massachusetts was closed. During all the trouble with England, our first child was born on July 14, 1765. We named her Abigail. I was pleased that John wanted that name. Now there was a new little nabby in our family. It pleased me too when Father christened the baby and dedicated my child to the Lord. I remember a cold day in November when I christened you, Father said. Now I am going to christen another Abigail. His eyes clouded over with memories as he went on. It was so cold that day we needed an Indian tomahawk to crack the ice in the baptismal font. Then he brightened as he said, "There'll be no need of such goings on this hot day in July." As talk went on about the Stamp Act, I remembered John once said that England would not be able to hold on to her colonies if they would ever unite against her. I wondered if the colonists would really ever be angry enough to unite. Not a single stamp was sold in America. In May 1766, the Stamp Act was repealed. John had spoken out against the Act and had written resolutions against it. The town of Boston had asked John to present a petition against the Act to the British governor in Massachusetts. All this activity was making John one of the most important men in the colony. A little over a year later, my beloved grandfather Quincy died. It was the first loss of someone dear that I had ever known. Without my faith, knowing that grandfather was with the Lord, I couldn't have taken my loss very well. "He that believeth on the Son hath everlasting life," John 3:36, I reminded myself. I cried as I lay in my four-poster bed with my new baby. Just 2 days before my grandfather's death, our first son was born, July 11, 1767. We named him John Quincy, in honour of grandfather. Chapter 7. Happenings in Boston. We had lived in Braintree for more than 3 years when John came into my kitchen one day. He sat at the table watching me stir the stew in the iron kettle. I knew he had something on his mind and was wondering how to tell me. "John," I said, "do not worry about phrasing as if you were preparing a court case. Tell me simply what is on your mind." "Very well," John said. "I think we should move to Boston." "Boston," I repeated. It had never crossed my mind that I would leave my little home in Braintree. "My cousin Sam Adams has advised it. He thinks my law practice would grow in Boston." I looked at John's weary face. I realized that the 10-mile trip to Boston was much too much for him. Besides, I thought, John is becoming involved in the politics of Massachusetts and political happenings are taking place in Boston. "Yes," I said, "I think Boston is where we must be." "Then, Abby, I'll find a house to rent. When I have found a suitable place, we shall move." At the end of April 1768, we moved into a rented house in Brattle Square. It was in the busy part of the city. It was a good location for a lawyer. John's office was on the ground floor. I missed all my dearly beloved visitors in Braintree, but our home was not without callers. Sam Adams, a cousin of John's, came often. One day he said to me, My whole interest is in politics, Abby. I know I've held only small offices, but John says I have a great influence with the working people. What John says is important to me too, I told him. John Hancock came to our house often. He lived in a big stone mansion on Beacon Hill. My husband told me that when John Hancock's Aunt Lydia died, he would be the richest man in New England. John Hancock came one day beautifully dressed as usual, but with a ferocious frown on his forehead. "Parliament has passed the Townshend Act," he cried. "What does the Act mean to us?" I asked. "It puts a tax on tea, glass, lead, paper, and painters' colours. This time, I fear, the King is determined to have the new law obeyed." "Dear Father in Heaven," I prayed, "give us the strength to bear up under these injustices." "Amen," said Mr. Hancock. But in September the injustice became worse. At the wharf I saw an English ship bringing two regiments of troops to Boston. The British soldiers in their bright red uniforms were everywhere. "They came to see that we pay them the new taxes," one man grumbled to another as I walked by. "Nobody in Boston's going to house the lobster backs," cried the other man. What I overheard that day at the wharf came to pass. People refused to house the soldiers. Most of them were camped on the common, a grassy plot in town. The common was only 3 blocks away from our home. I awoke one morning with strange sounds in my ears. It was the roll of drums and the high notes of fifes. Then there was the tramp, tramp, tramp of boots on the cobblestones. An officer yelled out commands. I sat upright in bed. I could hardly stand the sounds of the camp. I was physically shaken. During all this trouble, my third child, little Susanna, had died. Her death and the presence of the British in Boston made me yearn for our home in Braintree and the quiet and security there. However, I never faltered in my belief in God's wisdom. I knew He directed our steps. One night in March, John went to a political meeting at the south end of Boston. Our two children were snuggled in their beds. Suddenly, church bells began to ring. A cry from the street, "Town born, turn out!" It was the cry of the Sons of Liberty, a secret society organized to fight against the unfair laws. Running to the window, panic gripping my throat, I leaned out. I called out to the men and women running towards King Street. "What is happening? Where is everyone running to?" The children heard me and ran in fright to my side. They hugged my skirts, looking up at me wide-eyed and trembling. I cuddled them to me. There was the unmistakable sound of guns firing. My thoughts were with John. Where was he? Was he safe? "Dear Lord," I prayed, "watch over him." Suki, the maid, and Jonah, the houseboy, rushed into the room. "Mistress Adams, Mistress Adams," they called out. "Everyone is going to King Street. It must be bad." "Go, Jonah, go," I commanded. "Find your master. Find out what has happened and hurry back with the news." "I want my papa. Is my papa hurt? I want my papa," little John Quincy sobbed into my skirts. But Nabby's crying almost drowned out his voice. A stiff wind blew cold into the room as I looked out the window, drawing the children to me. I glimpsed a familiar figure running towards the house. It was John. The children still clinging to me, we hurried to the front door. "Praise be to God, you're safe," I cried. As John removed his cloak, he kissed the children and then nodded to Suki to take them to bed. His words tumbling at an excited rapidity. "I was at the meeting when we heard the church bells. We thought it was a fire alarm and ran out into the street with fire buckets. We followed the crowds of people to King Street. When we got there, the snow was red with blood and bodies were being carried away." "What happened?" I asked, wide-eyed with amazement. "Boys and men were throwing snowballs. They jeered at one sentry in front of the townhouse. Someone flung a stone. Others followed. Somebody went for the officer in charge, a Captain Preston, who was in the warehouse across the street. That should have quieted the crowd, I said. It didn't, John went on in frantic haste. Preston sent a corporal and 7 men and then he came himself. Did the crowd back away then? Indeed they didn't, replied John. They continued to call the soldiers bloody backs and lobsters. And then young Henry Knox, the bookseller's assistant, asked Captain Preston if he was going to give the order to fire. Preston said no, not if he could restore order without it. Good for Captain Preston, I said. John went on, but someone knocked a soldier's weapon out of his hand, at the same time striking him over the head with a wooden club. The soldier pulled the trigger. Other soldiers did the same automatically. I stood in shocked silence. John's story sent shivers of fear through me. Each shot found a target. 5 people died, 8 were wounded. We walked to the kitchen where I brewed tea. We heard English soldiers walking past the house on patrol duty. But we were English too. How impossible this all seemed. Bells continued to ring, drums thudded, people in the street were calling, "Townsfolk, turn out to arms!" There was a knock at the door. It was a select man. "Come with us, John," he said. "We're going to stingy Tommy Hutchinson's and demand that he order all soldiers back to barracks." John did not return until dawn. Before he dropped into an exhausted sleep, he told me that Captain Preston had been arrested, along with those of his men who had fired. They would stand trial in Boston. Months dragged by as John and Josiah Quincy worked on almost nothing else but the case of the British soldiers. It was August before the case was tried. The days the soldiers were being tried, I rose early. I wanted to be in the courtroom when John presented this unpopular case. I knew people would brand him as an English sympathiser and call him Tory. I admired my husband for taking the side of right as he knew it to be. The courtroom was filled with people. This was an important case. There were 4 judges on the bench, all wearing the official full wigs and red robes. John was in his black robe, and he too wore a full white wig. His blue eyes were an overcast grey as he began pleading his case. I knew he had questioned 96 witnesses, including Patrick Carr. Patrick had died, but before he died he had given a statement to his doctor, which John used in court. Patrick had told the doctor, "I bear no grudge. The soldiers only did their duty. They fired in self-defense." My heart swelled with pride as I listened to John present the facts in his logical way. The trial lasted for 11 days, and then the verdict was passed down, not guilty, for Captain Preston and the 6 soldiers. The 2 soldiers who fired first were found guilty of manslaughter and branded on their hands for punishment. After the trial was over, the soldiers crowded around John. One soldier said, "You are a brave and honest man. We owe our lives to you." Once again my heart filled with love and pride. I hoped that now the strife would be over between England and the colonies. But there was more to come, much more. By 1773, the Townshend Act had been repealed and taxes had been lifted on all imported goods except tea. I breathed easier and busied myself with our new babies, Charles, who had been born to us in May of 1770, and Thomas in September of 1772. We returned to Braintree, for John was exhausted by his work in Boston. John rode the court circuit again. It was a 40-mile circuit, and he was gone for many days at a time. But I contented myself with writing letters to John and visiting Mercy Otis Warren, my friend at Plymouth, enjoying stimulating conversations and tea in her gambrel-roofed house among the trees. Such enjoyment was soon curtailed by that baneful weed, tea. Because of the Whigs' fury over a tax on tea, John was asked once more to return to Boston. This time John bought a house on Queen Street. I settled the family in while John flung himself into arguments over that troublesome brew. When November came, a ship named Dartmouth sailed into Boston Harbour with a cargo of tea. I knew there was to be trouble. I sought strength for the days to come. The only comfort for me was the scripture. I read over and over again, "Draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you." James 4:8. "And my help cometh from the Lord, which made heaven and earth." Psalm 121:2. The trouble I feared drew closer. One day John told me, "The colonists will not drink tea. It's not the price to which they object, but being taxed without their consent." Every night John took his turn as guard at Griffin's Wharf. Governor Hutchinson had told Mr. Roach, the captain of the Dartmouth, that the ship could not leave the harbour unless it was unloaded. If it was not unloaded in 20 days, the tea would be seized by the customs officers. "They will not land the tea," John exclaimed, pounding the desk with his doubled-up fist. But one night he came home weary and discouraged-looking. "Abby," he said, "now there are two other ships carrying cargoes of tea tied up at Griffin's Wharf." On December 16, when I should have been gay with the holiday spirit, a heavy doom seemed to fill me. I tried to think about the blessing of the Saviour's birth. John was away on a business trip. During his absence, my cousin Will Smith came to call. He grinned as I opened the door. "I've come to borrow your old red blanket, Cousin Abigail," he said. "You are welcome to the blanket, Cousin Smith," I said, trying not to show how startled I was. "But may I ask why you need it?" "We're going to have a saltwater tea party," was all the explanation he gave. He grabbed the red blanket and called over his shoulder, "I'm off now to the Green Tavern." I had to know what was happening. I called to Jonah, who had just entered the back door. "Jonah," I called, "what is going on?" "Everybody's going to Griffin's Wharf," Jonah said, his voice falsetto due to his excitement. "Sam Adams has given the word. People say Boston Harbour will be a teapot tonight." I could not stay at home. I had to see what was happening. Jonah pushed a path for me as we made our way into the crowded streets. At the wharf, Jonah found a cask on which I could stand. It was possible to see because dozens of pine torches burned brightly. The wharf was stirring with people. There were three groups of men and boys wearing blankets, their faces covered with fireplace soot. They carried axes over their shoulders and had colourful feathers in their hair. They were taking their places near each of the ships. There was a flame of freedom in their eyes. I felt for their cause, and yet I feared for them. In the midst of the tumult, I bowed my head and said silently, "Lord, dismiss them with thy blessing. Give them hope and comfort from above." "Me know you," called each person as he joined the group. "That must be the password," I told Jonah. The full moon shone down from a clear December sky. The ships and their riggings were clearly visible. Men made their way up the gangway of each ship, the Eleanor, the Beaver, and the Dartmouth. The crowds watched in hushed silence. I saw the captains come on the decks. From their movements, it looked as if they were giving over their keys. The chests of tea were brought to the deck. Sounds of splintering wood filled the damp air. Then there was one splash after another. Whoosh! Broken chests were drifting on the water. The smell of tea wafted from the harbour. The tea leaves drifted with the current. Finally, one by one, the men came down the gangplank. A fife began to play. Drum rolls began as the men started to march to the townhouse. The crowd watched quietly. Jonah and I trailed behind the thinning crowd. I was too disturbed to sleep that night. It was with great relief that I greeted John on his return from his business trip the next day. As soon as I told him about the tea party, which Jonah and I had watched, he went to Sam Adams' house to get the full details. John soon returned with the news. "The tide was low," he said. "There is tea along the shore as far as Dorchester." "How much tea was destroyed?" I asked. "Sam says about 300 chests, about 18,000 pounds. "Who will pay the cost of this Indian caper?" I asked. John looked down and gripped his hands together as he spoke seriously. "Boston will, and perhaps the price will spread far beyond Boston." Chapter 8. Pewter and Bullets. It was May when Boston learned of her punishment. Governor Hutchinson returned to England and General Gage was appointed Royal Governor Gage. The first act of the new governor was to close the port of Boston. Boston's door, the Atlantic Ocean, was closed and locked. Sailors, merchants, field hands, and shipbuilders were idle. Everyone began calling the new laws the Intolerable Acts. John, I said to my husband over breakfast, your law practice depends on all these people who are now out of work. True, Abigail, he nodded. We can afford to live here no longer. We will have to move back to Braintree. A lump rose in my throat as I realized we must leave the Boston home to whatever would happen to it. At Braintree we heard that other colonies were in sympathy with Boston. They deeply resented what England was doing. If it can happen in Boston, it can happen here, their leaders complained. John left again to meet with others at Salem. There John wrote, "The unhappy differences between Great Britain and the American colonies were debated. The 13 colonies are to meet in a Continental Congress in Philadelphia." The Massachusetts delegates were chosen, Thomas Cushing, Samuel Adams, Robert Treat Paine, and John Adams. On our farm, John and I walked together before he was to leave. We walked through the cornfields, the barley rows, the orchards, the dairy, and the pens. He gave instructions as to how I was to run the farm while he was gone. We went to church and prayed. Then I rode into town with him and stood in the crowd as he and other delegates climbed into the stagecoach. Although I did not hear from John for 5 weeks, the newspapers did write of his safe arrival. At last a letter came. They were greeted with enthusiasm everywhere they went, John said. But I was troubled. The summer was hot and dry. The crops faded. Since the cows did not have enough grass, the milk supply dwindled. Dressing, feeding, and playing with the 4 children helped me forget my fears and troubles, and I became their teacher. We read the Bible together constantly. The children and I found great hope in the Holy Book. I helped the men on the farm and did most of the cooking, even though I had 2 servant girls. There was always butter to be churned, candles to be made, and spinning and weaving to be done. John returned a troubled man. Then in April, a horseman came to our house after midnight and told us, "The sexton of Christ Church in Boston has hung 2 lanterns in the steeple to warn everyone that the British regulars are coming by sea. Paul Revere has mounted a fast horse and ridden to Lexington. William Dawes has gotten by the sentry at the neck. Church bells have sent other riders along the coast." "What has happened? What could have happened?" I asked John over and over again. "I'll ride to Concord and find out," John said, when he too could no longer tolerate the suspense. On the 18th of April, General Gage sent troops to seize the powder the people had collected at Concord and to arrest the traitor leaders. Paul Revere learned of these plans and galloped ahead of the British and warned the people. "How brave of him," I exclaimed. "When the British reached Lexington," John went on, "they found a small company of minutemen on the village green, headed by Captain Parker. When the minutemen stood their ground and would not disperse, the British fired a volley of musket shots, leaving 8 of the patriots dead or dying on the green. Reaching Concord, the British destroyed the powder and then started the long march back to Boston. They were fired on from behind stone walls and apple trees. The colonial militia, aroused for miles around, closed in on Boston 16,000 strong and held Gage in his own capital." Tears sprang to my eyes. "May God forgive our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us," I whispered softly. "There is no hope that the English or the patriots will forgive each other now," John said, bowing his head sadly. "King George will not listen to our petitions after these happenings. I shall have to leave for Philadelphia." When John left this time for Philadelphia, he held me close and said, "In case of real danger, flee to the woods with our children." John had been gone a few days when one morning I woke with a start. I crept out of bed and tiptoed to the window. I heard again the sound which had awakened me before. It was a warning drum. Away over the hill I heard the meeting house bell ringing. Could it be that the British were coming to Braintree, I wondered. After dressing quickly, I called the maids, Susie and Patty. Dress the children, there's trouble, I commanded. Why are we getting up this early, the children wanted to know. Eat your breakfast, children, I answered as calmly as I could. We have a busy day ahead. While the children ate, I ran to the barn and told one of the farmhands to find out why the meeting house bell had been rung. When he came back, he was breathless from the long, hard run. Between short breaths, he panted, "The English are coming. Everyone is running for their lives. Our neighbours are piling their belongings into carts and getting away from here." I looked out the window. The road was jammed with carts and wagons piled high with furniture, pots and pans and bedding. People were sitting on top of their belongings or hanging on the sides of their wagons. Horses were straining under their heavy burdens. "Run," they called out to me, "the British are coming." The maids cowered in the corner of the kitchen. The children left their places at the table, their food half eaten. They clung to me. Charles and Tommy began to cry. The wagons, the frightened children, the shouting all brought back memories of that night in Weymouth when the meeting house burned down. I remembered how frightened Mary and I had been. I remembered how Mother's quiet and composure had calmed us and made us feel safe. Now it was my duty to help my children over this frightening experience. "Father, please be with me," I prayed. Walking unhurriedly to the kitchen table, I said as calmly as I could, "We'll stay here in the safety of our home. There are no British soldiers here. The Minutemen may be coming soon. They will be needing breakfast. We should have food ready for them. Johnny, help the men put up the tables. Nabby, get the bowls and spoons on the tables. Tommy and Charlie, get water from the well for coffee." God gave me the strength. Susie and Patty came out of the corner. They got the largest kettles and slung them on the cranes over the fire. The children hurried to do their assigned chores. They were less afraid in their busyness than they would have been sitting in wait for something to happen. Something did happen. The Minutemen did come. When they saw all the food we were preparing for them, they looked as if they couldn't believe their own eyes. "You haven't run away," one of the men said in wonder. The men were hungry. They accepted the food gratefully. They ate quickly and were ready to leave when one of the men said, "I wish we had some pewter like those spoons you have hanging on the wall, Mrs. Adams. Our men would almost give their ears for as much as you have here." I stared at my spoons for a moment. How carefully I had chosen them before John and I were married. Now they had a more important use. Freedom and the God-given rights of the people were more important than pewter. I walked to the fireplace and unhooked the long spoons and other utensils I had hung there. I opened the cupboard drawers and took out handfuls of tableware. "You may have all my pewter," I told the men. "You are a good friend to the just cause of the patriots," one man said. The men put the big iron soup kettle on the logs. I threw the pewter into it. With a stirring rod, I pushed the pewter down into the kettle. "When the pewter has melted, make your bullets," I told them. The men quickly made their bullets from the liquid and were soon on their way to meet the British. The months wore on. A few letters from John came through from Philadelphia. John was impatient with the Congress. He wrote that the Congress was as slow as snails. I wrote an account of our life to John. "Soldiers come for lodgings, for breakfast, for supper, for drink, etc. Sometimes refugees from Boston seek asylum for the day, a night, a week. You can hardly imagine how we live, and yet, to the houseless child of want, our doors are open still, and though our portions are but scant, we give them with a will." I wish you were nearer to us. We know not what a day will bring forth, nor what distress one hour may throw us into. I am, with the tenderest regard, your Portia. The maids told me that word about my pewter and about feeding the housing of the needy had spread up and down the coast. People say she's the only one who didn't run away. She's a heroine. I was very humbled by this praise. I felt I had merely observed the opportunity to help. I had faith that God would help the righteous. Early on the morning of June 17, I was awakened by what sounded like thunder. Looking out the window, I could see no sign of a storm. I ran to wake Johnny and Nabby. "Johnny, run and get the spyglass, please, and Nabby, stay close to the children," I said. A wild explosion shook the house. Nabby and Johnny's eyes were wide with fear and wonder. They stood motionless, looking at me for an explanation. "Johnny," I explained, "you and I are going to the top of Penn's Hill." Penn's Hill was a short distance from our home. It was one of several hills which overlooked Boston. Cannons fired over our cornfield. The house shook and the dishes rattled in the cupboard. The window panes rattled as if they would burst out of their frames. Taking Johnny's hand, we climbed together to the top of Penn's Hill. We had a clear view of the town of Boston and the ocean to the east. North of Boston lay Charleston. Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill were beyond. Looking through the spyglass, I realized that during the night, the Americans had fortified these hills, for there were walls of dirt with guns sticking out. Even though we were 10 miles away, the spyglass brought it all very close. There was another tumultuous sound, like the one which had awakened me. It came from the ships. "Look, Mother," Johnny said, pointing to the ships. "I see red flashes from the ships, and there are puffs of smoke." My hands trembled so that I could no longer hold the spyglass. Johnny took it from me and looked through. He stood very close to me. Then he too dropped the spyglass and, putting both arms around me, asked, "Is this a battle, Mother?" "Yes, Johnny," I answered. "The guns from the ship fired all the morning. The Americans had taken positions on Breed's Hill, which was closer to the city than Bunker Hill. The sun was high in the sky when the British commander in Boston sent his soldiers to attack. The British were forced to retreat." Johnny and I made our way back to the house and stayed just long enough to see that the children were all right. In the afternoon, Johnny and I returned to Penn's Hill. We saw the British row across the water and attack the Americans for the second time. The Americans fired many times. The British retreated. The red coats of the dead and dying men made bright spots of colour all over the hillside. It was a sad sight. "Johnny," I said sadly, "please bow your head for these fallen men." We prayed. "The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the communion of the Holy Spirit be with you all." But the prayer was too late for many soldiers. When the British attacked the third time, the Americans did not fire back. The Americans were driven off. The noise ceased. Taking Johnny's hand, I led him down Penn's Hill. Back in Philadelphia, John did not know of the Battle of Bunker Hill, and the letter he wrote was full of good cheer. "I can now inform you that Congress has made a choice of the modest and brave George Washington to be General of the American Army. He is to report as soon as possible to the camp before Boston. The liberties of America depend upon him in a great degree." I smiled with satisfaction. I knew it was John who had proposed George Washington's name. John wrote again after receiving some Boston battle news. He told me about the psalm reading and prayer the Reverend Duché had given the Congress. "You must remember this was the morning after we heard the horrible rumor of the cannonade of Boston. I never saw a greater effect upon an audience. It seemed as if heaven had ordained that psalm, the 35th, to be read that morning." After this, Mr. Duché unexpectedly to everybody struck out into an extemporary prayer for America, for the Congress, for the province of Massachusetts Bay, and especially the town of Boston. Washington was kneeling, and Henry and Randolph and Rutledge and Lee and Jay, and by their sides there stood, bowed in reverence, the Puritan patriots of New England. George Washington came to Watertown near Boston on July 2, 1775. The next day he took command of the New England militia. Everyone went to get a glimpse of this new commander on whom so much depended. I too was anxious to see this Virginia squire, who was a planter and a slave owner. Besides, he was one of John's favourites. I held with John that this surely was the leader who was needed so very much.
Part 4.
I saw George Washington the day after his arrival. He was riding his horse down the street. He wore a blue coat with buff facings and buff-coloured breeches. This was the new uniform of the Continentals. He wore a sword at his side, a cockaded hat on his head, and the markings of his rank on his epaulets. There was a reception for Washington. I felt fortunate to be invited. As I entered the room and was guided to where General Washington was standing, I curtsied in my very best Grandmother Quincy fashion. General George Washington impressed me greatly as we spoke of John and his work in Philadelphia. We both spoke of what we hoped for the colonies. As I returned home after the reception, lines from Dryden came to me. They seemed to apply directly to the man I had just met. Mark his majestic fabric. He's a temple, sacred by birth and built by hands divine. His soul's the deity that lodges there, nor is the pile unworthy of the god. Chapter 9. Independence. Boston was free, but not the 13 colonies. General Washington moved his army to New York. He was sure the British would attack there next. Late in March, I wrote John a long letter. I long to hear that you have declared independency, and by the way, in the new code of laws which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you to remember the ladies. Be more generous and favourable to them than your ancestors. When the letter was sent, I wondered if John or any of the new lawmakers would actually consider women and their rights in the laws of the United 13 Colonies. But matters of state did not concern me long. An epidemic broke out. It was not smallpox this time, it was dysentery. John's brother Elihu was one of the first to come down with the malady. I hurried to my dear mother-in-law's side. The older woman was weary from nursing. Day and night I tended Elihu. He grew weak. I dreaded to tell John the fatal news. Elihu was dead. When I returned home, I heard a groaning from the barn. I ran as fast as I could to see who was in such pain. It was Isaac, my own stableman. I helped him to the house. Soon I became sick too with the horrid disease. The new doctor came and bled Isaac. I prayed constantly. Patty the maid became sick. I wasn't well myself, but I knew I had to help the others as I could. With all my dwindling strength I tried to save Patty. I could not. She died. I reminded myself of Romans 8:18, for I reckon that the sufferings of the present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Tommy was growing more pale every day. I knew my child would be next. I prayed fervently beside Tommy. Mother had tried to help administer to the sick, and word came that she had taken the disease and died. My heart was bursting with grief. But gradually, with God's help, my grief became bearable. Finally, the epidemic ended. I was thankful to God that my children were all safe. The following June, John was on a committee to write a Declaration of Independence. Toward the middle of July, I received a letter from John which made my senses reel. The 13 colonies were to be united. They were to be a nation. The nation was to be called the United States of America. John wrote that he believed the day of the uniting of the states was the most important day in the history of America. I called the children and read his letter to them. It will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with games, bells, and bonfires from one end of the continent to the other. From this time forward, forevermore. The children jumped up and down in their excitement. I hurried outside and rang the farm bell. The children followed me and joined hands in a circle and romped around and around in their glee. Then I said, "Come, children, let us go back into the house." This was a time to remember God, his care and blessings. We all knelt to pray for God's guidance for our new nation. With John away, the farm work weighed heavily on me. Farm workers were scarce because nearly all the men had joined the army. Then there was the children's education to see to. The schoolmasters marched off to the army saying, "War's begun, school's done." I instructed the children myself. I taught Latin and French to Nabby and Johnny, and I taught Charles and Tommy to read and write. But the Bible was the most important book in teaching the children faith in God and concepts of right and wrong. The war went on. Supplies were short and there was little or no money. One day my son John Quincy came to me. "Mother," he said, "I have heard that there is a shortage of post riders. I have just come from General James Warren, who told me it is true. The men are all gone to war." "But Johnny," I protested, "you are only 9 years old." "But I can ride, Mother," Johnny insisted. "General Warren says I can carry the mail between here and Boston if I have your permission." I looked at my son, so small for his age. His legs did not look long enough to stretch over a horse that would be carrying saddlebags. He was so persistent and anxious to help. I said, "Yes, you may be a post rider, Johnny." We learned by post that Benjamin Franklin had been sent to France to ask that nation to help our new nation. Arthur Lee and Silas Deane were with Franklin. Johnny rode the post every day. He rode to Boston to pick up what riders brought in from Philadelphia and elsewhere. We began to think John would never come home again. Then one day in August, Johnny brought a letter which said John was coming home. He said he needed a horse. Our own horse was lame. Father offered to send his horse for John. We were bustling in preparation of the long-awaited visit when another dispatch from John said he had to put off his visit again because battles had started around New York. The Americans were losing, but John was working hard to build a better army. At last in October, another letter from John came. He was indeed coming. Johnny, Charles, and Tommy let out Indian war whoops. Every day was happier than the day before. Johnny wished he did not have to ride the post while his father was home, but Johnny was constant in his job. One cold day in January, Johnny came galloping home on his big bay horse. John had arrived while Johnny was riding post and ran out to meet him. Johnny jumped off the bay into his father's arms. He was trembling and obviously excited. Johnny took the saddlebags and, with an arm around our stammering Johnny, led him to the kitchen fire. Johnny drew a big red sealed letter from one of the bags and gave it to his father. Johnny's hand shook and he was trying to blurt out the news. As my husband read the letter, I saw his eyes change from blue to grey and then to clear blue again. Happiness and delight brightened his face like the sun sparkling on the sea after a storm. "God be praised," shouted my husband, actually doing a jig. "General Washington crossed the Delaware on Christmas night and overcame the Hessians." It seemed to me now, in the winter of 1777, after 4 years of distinguished service for the Continental Congress, that John would be free to take up his law practice again. But it was a vain hope. Congress called John to replace Silas Deane as a member of the Commission to France. "We shall all go with you, John," I exclaimed happily. "I shall ride to Boston and investigate what it would necessitate to take my family," John said. When he returned, he was tired. His eyes were clouded. "John, is it possible for us to come with you to France?" "There are difficulties," he replied, stretching his legs out towards the fire. "These are war times. There is a possibility that we may be captured. If that should happen, the English would try me for treason and execute me. I shudder to think what would happen to my wife and children." There was a long silence. Then John said, "Johnny has his heart set on coming with me." "Not Johnny," I cried. I gulped to hold back the sob that rose in my throat. How would I get along without my eldest? Johnny did so many things for me besides being the post rider.
It was Johnny I always turned to when I needed company and understanding when things were going badly. He was an excellent companion for the other three children. Little Nabby loved him so dearly, how she would miss him. John cleared his throat as if reluctant to break into my thinking. Then he said, "As you know, Abby, the chance for a good education is limited in the colonies. There are great advantages to the education that is offered in Europe." "But he's only 10. "I shall think about it," I said sadly. The next morning, Johnny came to me. He turned up his face, looking at me pleadingly. "Mother, you will let me go with Father, won't you?" he asked. "I could help Father, and Mother, I could learn. It is difficult to get a good education here. You've said so yourself many times." I turned my full gaze on him as he watched me with silent big eyes. "Yes, Johnny, you can go," I said. Then I hastily turned and left the room, lest I become emotional. I thought of the words from James 5:16, "The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much," and I prayed fervently for my two dear ones who would soon be leaving on a dangerous journey. 3 months later, from the top of Penn's Hill, I watched my two men leave from the landing at Mount Wollaston. The next day, my uncle, Norton Quincy, gave me a letter Johnny had written just before he went on board the ship. My uncle said the last thing Johnny said was, "Give my love to Mama." I tried not to weep, but tears stung my eyes. 6 months passed before I had a letter from John, but through the Boston Gazette I found out that John and Johnny had landed safely in France. In December I got two letters. John had written, but his other letters had been lost at sea. I learned that the voyage had taken months. They had been chased by British ships and saved by a hurricane, and then almost destroyed by it. I read they had been fired on and had fired back. Johnny had been unafraid and thrilled by it all. I wrote long letters to Johnny, telling him to study people and places and to ask about what he saw. I told him to use his intelligence for the benefit of himself and for his country's future. I asked him to make friends and, above all, to learn. I told Johnny the world was his schoolroom. John and Johnny were away for a year and a half. One sunny August morning in 1779, a coach drew up to our home in Braintree. John and Johnny climbed out. The children crowded around them, and such talking and laughing and hugging as went on. "My little boy has become a man," I thought, as I held my son close, very close. He was taller and even more serious than before. "John Quincy learned to speak French like a native," John said. "Youth is the only time to learn a language." That was a cue for the children, and Johnny spent the rest of the day granting their request to say something in French. Once again our joyous reunion was cut short, for in 3 months Congress gave John a new appointment. He was asked to join Franklin in Europe to work on a peace treaty. This time he took 9-year-old Charles with him as well as Johnny. But Charles was homesick. In January 1782, Charles came home with an officer of the United States Navy. Johnny had stayed. He had gone to Russia to be secretary to Francis Danner, the first minister to Russia from the United States. "If you had known that Mr. Adams would be away so long, would you have consented to let him go?" a friend asked me one day. "If I had known Mr. Adams would accomplish what he did, I would have endured his absence for 3 more years, I told her. Then came a letter from John. He was not coming home as I expected. Now he had been appointed to make a commercial treaties with the countries of Europe. But there was a high note in his letter. John said he would not accept the appointment unless his wife and daughter could join him in Europe. He wrote, "If you and Nabby were with me, I could keep up my spirits." 18-year-old Nabby was excited at the prospect of seeing her father and seeing Europe. John was making arrangements. We got caretakers for the farm and house in Braintree. Charles and Thomas were sent to live with my younger sister Betsy. With two servants, John and Esther Breesler, we boarded the ship Active on June 20, 1784. Chapter 10, Citizen of the World. It took 30 days to get from Boston to England. When I saw the Active on which I was to sail lying in Boston Harbour, I had misgivings. I was remembering back to my childhood when I had visited Uncle Isaac's ship. The seasickness I felt on board that ship in just a few hours would be possible to feel again on this ship for days and days. The Active was riding steady on her ropes, but she seemed very small to be crossing the vast ocean. Nabby and I were escorted up the gangplank by the captain, Captain Lyde, and a Scotsman, Mr. Green. Then a mere lad showed us down a narrow stairway as steep as ours in Braintree. He nodded to the door. "Your stateroom, ladies," he said. The stateroom was 8 feet wide with two bunks on either side. The bunks were a mere 3 feet wide, which left only 2 feet of empty space. There was a small window, but it opened to another part of the ship, not the sea. The ugly smell coming through was of cooking grease. "The men's quarters are in the dining room, too," the lad told us before he left. "Well," said Nabby, looking at our stateroom with a practical eye, "there's a bunk for you and for me and one for Esther. We can use the fourth one to lay out some of our things." "Our trunks won't fit in here," I said. "They'll have to stay outside." Esther wasn't saying anything. The poor young thing was turning yellow, and she was moaning already as the ship barely rocked. "Poor Esther," I said. "She's seasick, and we're still in Brattle Square. Come, Nabby, let's go on deck and watch the sailing." On deck, the sailors were casting off ropes. The captain was shouting orders. The sails were raised and snapped in the wind. The ship moved northward. The fresh, warm June breeze cooled our faces as we watched Boston getting smaller and smaller on the horizon. 2 hours later, the captain asked us to return to our stateroom and prepare ourselves for seasickness. When we got back to our stateroom, we saw that Esther had already been sick. A strange feeling stirred our stomachs. We put on our special oilcloth wraparounds and became sick ourselves. Nabby raised once that night, saying, "There is a Dr. Clark on board. Should I try to find him?" "No," I said, "he'll be busy with others. There's nothing much he can do for us. We must suffer this out, Nabby." Esther continued retching. Poor Esther hung for hours with her head over the side of the bunk. The next morning she raised her head and looked up at me from her pitiable position and said, "Mrs. Adams, would you please ask them to throw me overboard? I'm going to turn inside out anyway. I'd rather be dead." Breisler and two stewards found an empty bunk elsewhere for Esther. They carried her off like a sack of produce on Uncle Isaac's wharf. Breisler scrubbed the stateroom and then got seasick himself. For the next days and nights I held onto the side of the bunk to keep from falling out. Still, I was grateful for the strong winds which were blowing me closer to John. Finally, I was able to crawl up on deck. But the wind was so cold I couldn't stay there long. After being at sea 8 days, the sea was calm. When I awoke that morning, Esther was busying herself in our stateroom. She looked pale, but she was smiling. "Esther," I exclaimed, "it is good to see you on your feet." "I have clean undergarments for you," Esther said. "I've fetched water too. I'll get your soap now from the other bunk." At noon we all went to the galley for a meal. Instead of eating, I sat and watched in disgust. There were not enough knives or cups. There was a leg of pork and roasted fowl. 20 minutes later, beef was brought in. Then there was cake. When everyone had eaten, potatoes were served. When the pail of milk was brought in and I saw how dirty the pail was, I could keep silent no longer. "I'm surprised you haven't all been poisoned by now," I told the passengers. "Let me have that pail. I'll scrub it myself." When I returned with the pail, everyone clapped, led by Dr. Clark. After a month of sailing, the captain ordered a sounding. The sailors let down chains to find the depth of water. They found bottom at 55 fathoms. With a good wind, we would be in sight of land in a day or two. But we had a windless day and floated becalmed. The next morning we saw the cliffs of Dover. It was raining hard, but Nabby and I felt bright sunshine in our souls. At last we were to be united with John and Johnny, my greatest desire. Nabby said, Delight thyself also in the Lord, and he shall give thee the desires of thine heart. Psalm 37:4. I was so excited I had to lean against the ship's railing to steady myself. Captain Lyde told us that the Active would be in the channel a week before we could make it upriver. We were to land at Deal. Finally the day to land came, and we were wrapped in oilskins and lowered from the ship into a ferry. When we reached land, we still had to make a 70-mile trip in mail coaches to London. By evening, we were at Lowe's Hotel in Covent Gardens. There was no John to greet us. London was bigger and more beautiful than I had pictured it. The houses looked orderly along Grosvenor Square and Hyde Park. Nabby and I shopped. There were laces and bolts of expensive silks which were almost non-existent now in America. The fabrics were much better than the American goods. After 8 days, in spite of all the efforts of many American friends to show us all the sights of London, Nabby and I were getting discouraged. No word had come either from John or Johnny. We were glum. One morning we were getting ready to visit Mr. Copley. He was the artist who had painted John's picture. Suddenly, Breslow burst into the room, red in the face and puffing with excitement. "Mrs. Adams, ma'am," he said, trying to catch his breath, "John Quincy is here." "Here?" "Yes, ma'am, next door." "Why is he not here?" I asked in astonishment, pointing to our room. "He stopped to have his hair done." At my look of surprise, Nabby said, "Your son wants to present his best appearance, mother." Before I could make a reply, a young man entered the room. He was handsome, with his hair well powdered. He was tall, with aristocratic features and large expressive eyes. I stood staring at him. Could this be my 17-year-old Johnny? "Oh, my dear mamma," he said. I wanted to run to him and kiss him and hold him close to me, but he was too grown up for such an exhibition. I kissed him on the cheek. Nabby and Johnny were looking at each other with deep feeling shining from their eyes. Johnny took a step forward. "I would recognize my sister anywhere," he said, with admiration evident in the tone of his voice. Nabby curtsied, lowering her eyes. Her lips were quivering with excitement. "Oh, Johnny, it's God's blessing to see you." A day later, Johnny found a sturdy carriage that would take us to The Hague in Holland. The carriage had to be put on board a ship at Harwich, Johnny said, and would be taken off the ship at Helvoetsluis. It would be a 26-hour crossing. On the night before we were to go to Holland, I began packing. Johnny had taken Nabby to the theatre. I heard a heavy step in the hallway. The door flew open. John stood in the doorway. His clothes were dusty from travel. His wig was askew. At the sight of me, his face looked radiant. For a moment I could not speak. It had been more than 4 years since I had seen my beloved partner. When he swept me into his arms, the years disappeared. All the aches and fears and troubles left my heart. John held my face a few inches from his. "You haven't changed a bit, Miss Adorable," he said. "The very sight of you makes me feel 20 years younger." My heart was so full I could not speak. John went on. "I could not wait to see you. I managed to get passage from Holland. We'll go to France from here." "Oh, John," I cried, "I am eager to begin life again together." The four of us reached Paris by the middle of August. The dirt and obnoxious odours filled my nostrils. It was necessary to keep my handkerchief at my nose. It was best to breathe through the cologne to block out the ugly odours. As our coach clattered through the narrow streets of the city, Nabby said, "I never saw so many people in one place, even on the Boston Common." John Quincy laughed at his sister. "Paris is really a beautiful city, Nabby," he said. "Wait until you see the lovely gardens, the theatre and the art galleries and the ballet." "But look," protested Nabby, "there's a dead dog lying in the street on top of kitchen debris. The gutters are full of garbage." "Well, I've never liked the putrid streets of Paris either," said John. "Therefore I leased the house of the Comte de Renault in Auteuil. It adjoins the Bois de Boulogne, overlooking the River Seine, and is surrounded by beautiful gardens." The house was about 4 miles out of the city. It was a fine white stone mansion. Is it expensive? I asked, knowing that John's salary had been cut. Congress was allowing him very little. If we want our country to be respected, we must live up to a standard that will command respect, John answered. There were 8 servants on the staff beside the 2 Breslers. This was an extravagance that was hard for me to reckon with, especially since the French servants insisted on doing only the work in their own special line. There was not one who considered cleaning the stairway his work, and finally Breslau had to do it. However, the servant problem could not overshadow the good happenings. Fortunately, there were some of our good friends living in Paris. Mr. Franklin lived only a mile away. Thomas Jefferson, who was to work on treaties too, had come to Paris with his daughter Patsy, and we became close friends with the family of the Marquis de Lafayette. Madame de Lafayette, although from one of the wealthiest families in France, dressed simply and had charming manners. We saw much of each other. John Quincy took us sightseeing, but on Sundays I insisted we stay home. I told John pleasure seems to be the chief interest among the French. Even on the Sabbath they roust about. God's words, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, do not seem to apply here. We shall observe the Lord's Day. Yes, we shall, agreed John. Nabby soon pointed out that even the clothes we had bought in London were out of date in Paris. I heard of a little dressmaker who had been apprenticed to the Queen's dressmaker. We had new silk dresses made that were as fashionable as those worn by the ladies of the court, and less costly. As days went on, there were many official visitors at our mansion. I wished our reception room was more elegant. Extravagantly, I ordered new furniture. The chairs were beautifully carved and were covered with red damask. Abigail, John said almost reproachfully, are these not too expensive? Yes, they are, John, but there is nothing like them in Boston. I would like to take them home with us. John gave me a knowing smile. Even your grandmother Quincy never had anything so fine, he said. Early in 1785, Benjamin Franklin resigned and was given permission to return home. Thomas Jefferson was appointed minister to France, and John was appointed the first minister from the United States to England. My stay in France was over. One day I asked John to walk with me. We strolled along the Seine with budding spring flowers all around us. It was a sparkling day of sunshine. It will be a difficult job, John was saying. I don't know how the English will take to a minister from a nation which has just finished a war to separate us from them. How could I have ever thought Paris was dirty, I mused. It's a beautiful city. Let's drive up to the top of Montmartre for one more view of the city that I can carry with me forever. You are a romanticist, love, John. Paris has made me more tolerant of other people, I said. She has made me a citizen of the world. Can we, as citizens of the world, handle King George III? John asked. There would be no one better able to do it, I answered, trying to give John the confidence he needed. Secretly, I was worried about how we would be received in London, but I kept my fearful thoughts from John. John Quincy would not be going with us. He decided to return to the United States and study law at Harvard. There were many farewell parties, but the most difficult farewell was with the servants who wept when we left. I was surprised at the pangs I felt at parting with the servants, of whom I had become fond in the past 10 months. London was crowded at the end of May. It was King George III's birthday. John had rented a lovely house in Grosvenor Square. When John had his first audience with King George, Nabby and I could hardly wait to hear how he was received. What did you say to King George? Nabby asked. I said I thought myself fortunate to have the honour to be the first American to be minister to his court, replied John. I told him I hoped to restore the good relations between two people who have the same language and blood. The day arrived when Nabby and I were to accompany John to court to be presented to the royal family. My heart raced at the thought of meeting the King and Queen. Would I be clever? Would I be dull? I asked the dressmaker to make our gowns as simple as possible. My gown was white crepe. It was trimmed with lilac ribbons and mock point lace. The hoops beneath the skirts were bigger than I liked. The great train was much too long, but the dressmaker assured me it was necessary. I wore lace gloves and very handsome cap from which two white plumes rose to great heights. John presented me with matching pearl earrings and necklace for the occasion. Nabby's dress was also white crepe and trimmed with white ribbons. "My lands, ma'am," Esther exclaimed, "them long trains will sweep clean all the palace floors." We laughed at Esther, and she laughed too. On the day of the presentation, my hand shook visibly as we left for Buckingham Palace at 1 o'clock. Nabby and I in one carriage, and John and a Colonel Smith, who was John's new assistant, in another. When we arrived at the palace, we were escorted to a drawing room where there were over 200 people waiting to be presented. My heart pounded. Would I know what to say to King George? King George entered. He made a circle to the right. Finally, he came to me. His voice was low. I drew off my right glove, and the King George III kissed my left cheek. He said, "Mrs. Adams, have you taken a walk today?" I could not tell him that I had had no time for walks. I had spent the whole morning getting ready for this reception. I said, "No, sire." "Why, don't you love walking?" asked King George. "I am rather indolent in that respect, Your Majesty." Then King George was introduced to Nabby, who bowed beautifully. It was 2 more hours before Queen Charlotte decided to greet us. My silk shoes, made to match my dress, were not made for standing. My feet hurt, my back ached, and I longed to go home. Finally, Queen Charlotte, the princesses, and the ladies-in-waiting made their way to us. Queen Charlotte seemed to stiffen. Her face wore a pained expression. I sensed that she was embarrassed. "Mrs. Adams," she addressed me coolly, "have you got into your house?" "Not yet, Your Highness," I said, "but our furniture is expected daily from The Hague." She bowed stiffly and moved along. I was glad the presentation was over. Queen Charlotte had done little to hide her dislike of Americans. In a few minutes we were dismissed, and all the plans and work and anticipation were as nothing. When we were home, I told John, "That woman may be the Queen, but she is no lady." Chapter 11, The Vice President's Lady. Although diplomatic life took much of my time, Nabby took her share of my time too. Young Colonel Smith, John's aide, always seemed to be where Nabby was. He made it clear that he wanted her close attention, and he was getting it. He let her know by every look that he adored her. Soon Colonel Smith asked John's permission to marry Nabby. There was not much else to say but yes to Smith. He came from a good family, he was 30 years old, and had been one of Washington's aides in the Revolution. He was tall and clever. John and I agreed to the match. The Bishop of St. Athos agreed to perform the marriage ceremony. The patriots admired him because he had written that he looked up to America as the only great nursery of freedom now left upon the face of the earth. The ceremony was held in the embassy. It was hard for me to believe I had a daughter old enough to be married, but it was 1786, and Nabby would soon be 21. Colonel Smith and Nabby rented a house on Wimpole Street, not far from Grosvenor Square, and had dinner with us every day. In December 1787, John was given permission to resign his post and return home. It was not until April that we were ready to leave England. By this time, the new constitution had been written and was being considered for approval by the 13 states. Nabby and her husband, Colonel William Smith, did not wait to return with us. William wanted to get to New York as quickly as possible. He wanted to find out what possibilities there were for him in the new government. We had our last audience with King George III before we left London. He had been agreeable to John and me. When we came into King George's presence, he greeted us warmly, saying, "Madam and Ambassador Adams, I remember very well my first conversation with the representative of the new country. Mr. Adams told me I have no attachment but to my own country," a very admirable thing to say. Looking at the heavy-jowled, short, plump King of England, I remembered how once back in Weymouth I had admired him as a patriot king. I had quoted whole passages from one of the speeches he had given to Parliament. King George kissed my cheek. John and I backed out of his presence and hurried down the palace steps to our waiting carriage. Tears misted my eyes. I had come to like the King of England. 4 days later we left from Portsmouth on the Lucretia. Are you sure, Abby, that you can go back to simple life? John asked. I have seen life in high positions, I answered, but I am looking forward to returning to my little farm. I mean to retire to Braintree as a private citizen, John said. I've been out of my country for 10 years. I'll need time to settle in. I have no further ambition except to live my life quietly with my family as a farmer and perhaps a writer of history. But as the Lucretia sailed into Boston Harbour, an official barge left the dock carrying the Secretary of State and a committee sent by Governor John Hancock. A welcoming committee, John, I exclaimed. As we stepped off the ship, 2,000 Bostonians cheered us. Bells rang. There was booming of cannons. People waving hats and handkerchiefs lined the streets as our carriage, drawn by 4 matched bays, rode to the Hancock mansion. Slipping my hand into John's, I smiled up at my astonished husband. I never expected this, he whispered. I have considered what I have done rather modest. My failures have been numerous. As I bathed in Dorothy Hancock's 5-foot-long bathtub, my mind was not on the state dinner for 50 which the Hancocks were giving in our honour, but rather on the exciting emotion that we would see our sons again. The next day, John was received in the Representatives' Hall of the State House. Both houses gave him honours. John was glowing with pleasure. But the greatest pleasure of all was when we returned to the Hancocks' parlour and found Charlie and Tommy waiting for us. They were wearing spotless white shirts. Both boys wore long hair. I stared at my two sons unbelievingly. Charlie was now 18 and a junior at Harvard. He looked so much like Nabby. Tommy was past 15 and short and stocky. Holding back my desire to hug my boys and smother them with kisses, I waited until they came to us, bowing and shaking hands in the proper manner. "Johnny is very well," Charlie said. After graduating from Harvard with honours, he secured an apprenticeship with a leading lawyer, Theophilus Parsons of Newburyport, Massachusetts. "Johnny will be in Boston as soon as he can get transportation," Tommy said. Charlie relaxed a little after conversation had begun and leaned over to me and whispered, "We can't wait till we're all together at home, Ma." "We are going back to Braintree," I whispered back. "Your father will go before I do to make everything ready. I shall wait here in Boston for Johnny." John left at daybreak for Braintree, and at 10:30 Johnny arrived. Even though I had not seen him for 3 years, this time he had not changed. He was unkempt after his long ride, but still the fine, erect figure he had always been. Johnny rushed to me, taking both my hands in his, said, "Dear Mama, how good to see you, my dearest friend and counsellor." Throwing social customs to the wind, I held my son close and laid his head on my shoulder. Indeed, he was my friend. I thought back to my girlhood when I had yearned for a friend. I had found John. Now I had another dear friend, my oldest son. Johnny held me close as he said, "I have a whole month to spend with you and Papa." Back in Braintree, John spent all of his time bringing the farm up to usefulness. He hired men to clear the fields of stones, build fences, plough, and bring in hay. One afternoon, John came to the kitchen door with 6 Guernseys. "What are these?" I asked. "Cows," he said with a broad grin. "What are we going to do with them?" "Milk them." "But, John," I protested, "we have no cow barn." "I didn't consider that," said John. "I'm so anxious to be a farmer again, I just couldn't wait to get some cows." "Johnny and I have figured our books," I said. "It has already cost us $5,000 to fix the house and the farm." "That's exactly what the government owes us in back pay," John pointed out. By December, the states were having elections. Massachusetts chose its electors who could vote for the president and vice president. New York was chosen as the seat of the government. On the first Wednesday in February 1789, the electors of 11 states met in their capitals to vote. They sent their ballots to Congress in New York. George Washington was unanimously elected president. John was elected vice president, only because he had more votes than anyone else for the office. He received only 34 votes, which was less than half. "Abigail," he said, "I am angry. I am humiliated. Should I accept the vice presidency with so few votes?" My eyes filled with tears, but I spoke in a firm voice. "You have been elected," I said. "The Constitution does not provide any other way for us to get a vice president." In New York on April 13, George Washington came to the Senate chamber. John formally received him and then led him to the portico overlooking Wall and Broad Streets. Washington bowed to the crowd below. A great cheer went up for the war hero. He moved forward and stood close to the iron railing. Samuel Otis, Secretary of the Senate, raised the Bible from the table. Chancellor Robert R. Livingston of New York gave the oath of office. After George Washington took the oath, the Chancellor said, "Long live George Washington, President of the United States." It was a thunderbolt of a moment. The people cheered. The American flag was raised on Federal Hall. The ships in the harbor gave a 13-gun salute. The bells rang. President Washington returned to the chamber and gave his address. But I knew the vice presidency was not an important position. The Constitution had given him nothing to do except preside over the Senate. John would be important only if there was a great tragedy. John rented a house for us on Richmond Hill, a mile out of the city of New York. It was a lovely place with a view of the Hudson River. To the north there were fields where cattle grazed. To the south I could see the roofs of New York. "Like our new home?" John asked. "Oh yes, John," I smiled, "it's a lovely place, and besides I shall have nearly all my children with me." Nabby and her family lived in New York. Charles and Tommy would be with us. Johnny was in Boston practicing law and could make the trip frequently. "My first official act shall be to call on Mrs. Washington," I told John. "Yes," John nodded. Ordering our carriage, I was driven to the large house where the Washingtons lived on Cherry Street. President Washington introduced us and then excused himself. When I sat down to talk with Mrs. Washington, I knew instantly that I was going to like her. She was about 10 years older than me. She was short and plump. Her dress was simple, and she wore a cap on her shining, clean white hair. An almost instant friendship sprang up between us. "You have so much experience in politics, Mrs. Adams," said Martha Washington. "You must advise me what to do in this new circumstance in which I find myself. I have a fear of making mistakes." "I have lived a great part of my life on farms in Massachusetts," I said. "The only high society I've known is European. I will tell you all I know." Martha Washington and I became friends. We exchanged visits quite often. We went on outings together in the country, once spending 3 delightful days on an excursion to the Passaic in New Jersey. Then President and Mrs. Washington moved. When the Macomb House on Broadway was available, President Washington leased it. That spring was cold, wet, and windy. President Washington took a severe cold. It developed into pneumonia. A fourth doctor was sent for. The president was sinking rapidly. No one worked, news swept through New York, and people wept openly. After a visit to the Washington home on the 5th day of the president's illness, John and I came home in despair. I said, "I fear a thousand things which I pray I may never be called upon to experience." John was wiping his forehead and his damp hands as he paced the room in agony. His eyes were deep purple. "We simply cannot lose George Washington," he moaned. "He makes the government work. We need him. Oh, dear Lord, spare our great leader." The next morning I went to the Washington home to see if I could be of some help to Martha. She came out of the president's bedchamber. Martha crossed over to me, saying softly, "I fear he is dying. There is a rattle in his throat." I took her hand in mine. We bowed our heads. I prayed aloud, "Our Father, our shield and our defender, we call on thee to spare us our great leader whom we need in these troubled times. Almighty God, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen." Tears came to my eyes and spilled over my cheeks. I put my arms around Martha's shoulders. We stood looking at each other. Words were not necessary. When I returned home, John was sitting dejectedly in his chair. He glanced up. Seeing my tear-stained face, he buried his face in his hands and his shoulders heaved convulsively. Our prayers joined with the millions of prayers that were being spoken that day. The doctors had done all they knew to do. Only God could help. In the afternoon, the president's fever broke. There was great relief and rejoicing throughout the new nation. We turned our energies again to our country.